My name is Mary Templeton. I am the vice president of the Oregon Shorthand Reporters Association. And this bill to increase the minimum salary for court reporters from $7,200 to $10,000 a year will affect only two court reporters in the state, because quite simply all the others are up to this $10,000 figure. It's only in the county of Tillamook and in the county of... It's the court reporter in Tillamook and the one in St. Helens that it will affect. So, since all the other court reporters in the state make over this figure, it just makes it difficult to keep court reporters in those areas.
Who pays the additional funds? The county?
The county who employs
the county
it.
Sets your salary over and above what's in the salary statute.
See, this statute hasn't been changed for a long time. It's really more of a housekeeping measure than anything.
Well, the first $7,200 comes from where? The state or the county?
It's all paid by the county.
Right. Any further questions of Mrs. Templeton?
How does it happen that they're able to get anybody? These two counties.
Well, there are times when they have a great deal of difficulty, but reporters just starting out.
Senator Hoyt isn't a lawyer. You might explain a little bit how court reporters work.
Well, they usually the new ones that are just coming out of school will take a job in the smaller areas until they get accustomed to the court procedure, until they learn their business a little better, then they'll come on into Portland and work I don't know exactly how to explain how we work.
You work an 8-hour day, you work how many days a year?
Well, we work when court is in session. And some days we work very, very long days. The appointment of the court reporter is at the pleasure of the judge whose court it is.
So in addition to the work you do in the court, you also have the duty of an attorney dictating the transcripts for the court, the parties. So, and as I understand it, a monetize, you have to work hours well beyond the hour to do that other work because you record all day. Is that correct?
That's right. And in these small areas where there's only one court reporter, they have to do all the deposition work and all of that kind of thing. So
which is it?
Oh, yeah.
A lot of it is not so. A lot of times it's the judge himself that requires it.
That's right. Yeah.
I'm sure my, at least my question was really this. Since the marketplace apparently has set the fee in all the two counties at $10,000 or more already, I'm wondering just why that same system wouldn't be satisfactory in the two counties that you mentioned. In other words, if they can get someone satisfactory, well, certainly they're not, the demands are not such that they have to have somebody better.
Well, it depends. It depends on how the particular county operates. Now, you see, in Multnomah County, where I'm a court reporter, our salary is set by the city count, by the county commissioners. And I suppose that, I don't know exactly how they're set in these other areas, but a court reporter where there's only one court reporter in that area, it's very difficult for them to do much about getting their own salary raised, only one person. Unless there's somebody particularly interested in seeing that they do. As a matter of fact, in one of these areas, the judge raised the court reporter's salary, and there's a lawsuit in process right now.
Tell me, it's my understanding that your organization, the Oregon Court Reporters Association, has done a lot of work in upgrading the quality of reporters in the state. You also do a lot of work in recruiting reporters from outside the state and encouraging people to go in the court reporting business so that they're as good a supply of reporters as are in the state. Is that correct?
That's right.
Now, is this bill part of your upgrading process?
Oh, yes, because the court reporters simply, if they were to see the law in the state of Oregon says the minimum salary is $7,200 a year. They simply wouldn't come. That's all. You couldn't get a court reporter. So that's right.
Thank you, Mrs. Templeton. Who else wished to testify on Senate Bill 273?
Madam Chairman, anyone's not here to testify, but Mr. Harry Libby, who was a past national president of the Court Reporting Association. You think this bill is a good bill, Mr. Levy?
Very good. Very, very necessary bill to make sure that Oregon has competent reporters.
Testimonies, they're very efficient, these court reporters. They put all the testimony through the lips of one witness.
We don't wish to burden you.
We appreciate that. Let's turn to 287. Is there anybody here to testify on 287? Appears to be my bill. I'm Keith Burns. Did you put me up?
No.
The purpose of the bill is to, oftentimes after a divorce or a decree has been obtained, the party severs his relationship with his attorney. Therefore, it's not too efficient to have the service of a show cause or a modification put on the attorney's record, as he may well not represent the party anymore. The intent of this bill is that the service shall be made on the party and not on the attorney who obtained the decree.
Is
Susan, get another vote.
John says that in another bill, we deleted line 30 on page 287, 30 through the end of that page, and we deleted all of line 3, or of page 3, which he says necessitates some amendments in the first section of the bill. I think John will have to do a little work on it before we pass it down. Let's turn to 184.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jack Kalinowski. I'm here representing the Oregon Construction Industry Council, and I'd like to first open my testimony by saying that this bill was introduced at our request because, and we requested it because we're having just an awful lot of trouble dealing with administrative rules adopted or being promulgated and proposed for adoption by various state agencies. And just in outline form, I'd like to say that often we find that we're given inadequate time to prepare a response to proposed administrative rules. We find that at times...
You mean before they're adopted?
Yes, before they're adopted. We find at times the proposed rules are improperly presented. We've had a lot of problems evaluating amendments to proposed rules, and when rules are amended following the hearings, there are times when further hearings are warranted but not given. And we find also that upon adoption, rules are at times really not clearly stated. We find, incidentally, Senate Bill 184 doesn't solve all of our problems. We think it takes a major step towards the solutions of the problem. We find there's a very serious question that I think is very valid as to the consideration given by state agencies to testimony that's presented at the public hearings. I'd like
we
to also
have another bill which virtually duplicates this, and the question that's come up with the other bill is you find the notice adequate?
No, oftentimes we find the notice to be inadequate. Well, may I use an example, Madam Chairman? I'd like to show you this as an exhibit. This isn't what you think it is. It is one administrative rule that was promulgated by the Environmental Quality Commission. It's about 800 pages long. It's in two volumes. And incidentally, it cost us $64 to obtain. This rule was the history on this rule is this. It was published in the Secretary of State's bulletin on December 1st, 1971. Amendments to the proposed rule were distributed to those who held a copy of this on December 17, and the first hearing in Portland, first and only hearing in Portland, was on January 5, 1972, a period of about 35 days from the time it was first published until the time it was heard. Now, we contend, although this is an extreme example, and I want to admit that in the very beginning, the 35 days, especially when it encompasses the Christmas and the New Year's holidays, is simply not enough time to evaluate this and the amendments that were distributed on December 17th.
What agency was that for?
Environmental Quality Commission, Senator. I'd like to also give you another example. I have enough copies of this for each member of the committee here. This example relates to the Wage and Hour Commission. They were proposing a consolidated work order just in December of this year, or of last year, excuse me. And I wrote a page and a half letter to the Wage and Hour Commission telling them that the proposed rule had a number of faults in it, and that before we could present any kind of intelligent testimony, we'd like to have these clarified so we would know what was being proposed. Now I'm going to distribute to you a copy of the response I got to this letter, which says that nothing more than our questions can be taken up at the hearing. Well, that just isn't enough. We need to know in advance whether or not the what the rule is proposed to do, and all we're asking for in Senate Bill 184 is that in this particular instance that the rule be properly presented, and that if we don't have enough time to respond, that we be given an extension of time. Now I want to point out one more thing, and I'll try to be as brief as possible. Senator Brown.
Do you have any trouble getting a hearing? Is there always a hearing
down? Not always, but normally. There's I should say yes. Sometimes, and the Division of Health has done this, they'll use the emergency procedures, adopt a rule, and then hold a hearing after its adoption. This has created a number of problems. We're not proposing any change in that section. That allows that.
There's a different bill, you can put your finger on it, that had to do something with filing a brief.
Was it 171?
No, it's not.
Oh, excuse me.
I had a different bill that had to do with filing a brief.
I think 171, Madam Chairman, is the only one that he has introduced relating to administrative procedure.
I'll check it. Remember that day he came and testified on two bills.
Yes, Madam Chairman. The other had to do with perjury.
So actually, we don't conflict?
No, Madam Chairman.
Now, there's one word in Senate Bill 84 that I think gives or will give some people some concern, and I'd like to address myself to that now. And that's the word concisely, as it appears on line 30 of page 2. And I'd like to point out to the committee that word was selected after a considerable amount of conjecture. The word concise suggests the removal of all that is superfluous or elaborative. And we think the word is well chosen. It was chosen by the attorney and legislative counsel who drafted the bill, and after fussing with it for quite a time, we came to the conclusion that it perhaps is a very good choice. I don't have any more to add, Madam Chairman, but we do need some consideration. Administrative rules are being promulgated so fast, so many, that we almost have to have a person on our staff full-time just to review those rules that are being adopted. We need some assistance. We need to make sure that those that are adopted are clearly presented. We get an ample time to have input into them, that our input is evaluated, and that following adoption, they are clearly stated. we can understand them.
Questions of Mr. Callender?
Well, I hope that you are available another time. I look forward to a time when we're going to do some real digging and have some staff from agencies here on the front of the building.
Well, what do you want
today?
Because I
want to
set it up.
Well, I'm
interested
in the idea. I guess I would. I'd like to discuss this topic, Madam Chairman. I feel that both Senator Halleck and this gentleman in their bills have brought up at the same exact same section something that, yet the weaknesses are as explained. I would like to do all we can to correct them because I happen to be a strong supporter of the theory of the Administrative Practices Act. And I want, as our weakness, I wanted to make it better so it works.
I don't think we're going to hear from them unless we specifically call them. So if you could tell me
I think in the first place, maybe it's the Secretary of State. Does he only have the publishing responsibility?
Yeah.
And that's all. I'd like to go to the operations. Then I would presume that it would have to be the Attorney General's office.
I don't know. Each department sets its own rules, or he sets his own rules. It might be that in some instances he advises it to them that he's writing. I don't know. I can find out.
Well, in that case, I'd like to hear from.
Well, isn't Peter here, Peter Herman?
I'm here on HBA, Pete's here on State Line, so I'm out loud, and maybe I can answer something.
Yeah.
I'm sure the Attorney General will charge us for being a witness.
He won't get paid.
We might have to get the physical impact on this.
My services are free to you, Senator.
Mm-hmm. Further questions of Mr. Callender?
I can pay you for it, Jack.
Thank you, Jack. Mr. Peterson?
Thank you. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is William Peterson. I'm a member of the legal staff of the State Workman's Compensation Board. So here is one agency expressing itself on this bill anyway. I'm here to oppose the amendment oppose the bill which amends this section of the APA for the Workman's Compensation Board. We don't feel that the bill is necessary. But more than that, if the problem is one requiring a solution, we think this bill poses more problems than it solves. Mr. Kalinowski mentioned a number of things that caused them problems with the adoption of agency rules, but the bill itself seems to address itself only to two. One, that there is insufficient time to present their views, and two, that rules are written unclearly, the problem of bureaucratic bafflegab. Regarding insufficient time, the statute itself requires at least 20 days notice of any intended agency action, whether it be adoption or holding of a hearing in anticipation of eventual adoption. Paragraph B of the present statute, which is renumbered C here, really speaks to the question. It says that the agency shall afford all interested persons reasonable opportunity to submit data, views, arguments, and so forth, orally or in writing. And it seems to me if there are a clear instance where this was not done, it could very possibly invalidate the rule that was adopted. Failure to give the 20 days notice should invalidate the rule. Regarding whether or not the rules should be written clearly, it seems difficult for us to see where the legislature can require clear writing or concise English, as laudable as that might be. If there is a true failure to write a rule adequately clearly, you then get into the court test question of whether it wouldn't be void for vagueness. So there is a court solution to an unnecessarily vague rule. The people involved with the APA, I didn't attend it, but following the adoption of the Administrative Procedures Act and the Attorney General's model rules, there was a fairly extensive Administrative Hearings Institute held on the coast last June, and one of the sessions specifically addressed writing a readable rule, and the light starts right out with the language, be clear and be simple. and directs itself to it, and then also comments on the problem that an agency will run into that's void for vagueness test if they don't manage that. I don't know how much time was devoted there to it, but it is a concern. If, however, the bill is given serious consideration, there are some things about it that are distressing to us. First of all, it almost speaks in this first edition, paragraph B, as if we were dealing with an adversary proceeding or a contested case. There really isn't a party to a rulemaking adoption proceeding. It probably should read person or interested person. This is on line 13, where the word party is used when a party requests. This particular section of the APA deals with rulemaking, not with contested case proceedings. The term response suggests a little bit a type of answering pleading. It probably should have additional time to present views. Those are details, but they could be troublesome. In fact, an agency is not required to hold a hearing under the APA, and it is required to give an opportunity for people to be heard. They can either be heard in writing or they can be heard at a hearing. The Attorney General's model rules goes a step further and provides that if 25 people or more request a hearing, then the agency must grant one. It's not clear to us whether this particular addition to the statute is intended to apply only when we're talking about hearings or to apply generally.
Have all agencies adopted the Attorney General's model rules?
I think maybe 80% or more have. Mr. Lally could probably answer that question.
Right.
We're also troubled by the burden placed on the agency in this same section. It in effect says that an agency shall grant an extension of time unless they clearly find the request unreasonable. There is no burden that the request or even state its reasons, and it could be a hopeless fact problem for an agency to find out that it was in fact unreasonable. It would seem to us that it should be turned around and that one should have to state reasons, and if they're reasonable, then the agency perhaps should grant some extension of time. There's another problem. If you are dealing with a case where the agency has set a hearing, if there's an extension of the hearing, this puts the agency right back into the spot of having to start out with notice provisions again, because they have published notice in various ways, and I think would be back at the starting gate if they were going to extend the hearing date. Now, they probably could hold a hearing and then hold it open or, yes, excuse me. I don't know what the cost is. I can't answer that question.
Can I follow that? Do you ordinarily, as a matter of fact, send notices to interested people in addition to the notice in effect that states?
I think the agencies vary a great deal in this. The Attorney General's model rules require that the UPI and the Associated Press both receive notice. They further require the Secretary of State's bulletin notification is done. And I think there's another requirement that they, if it's practical to do so, let all their licensees know. And that's got some indefinite wording in it. As a matter of fact, the Workman's Compensation Board does an extensive job of publication. We print something like 900 notices. They go, in some cases, bunches, like about 100 go to the State Accident Insurance Fund for distribution to its field offices. There's 400 or 500 go to insurance agencies, but we publish in the Oregonian, the Journal of Commerce, send notices to, the Construction Industry Council, which Mr. Kalinowski represents. So we probably go well beyond the requirements of the Act. I can't say, though, that that's general agency practice, but it would pose a burden to us to have to start and reprint another 900 to notify people that we had rescheduled the hearing date because one person said they wanted it extended. The practical solution for granting more time would seem to be simply to allow more time before finally adopting the rule to let someone send in a written response or to hold the hearing open and reconvene it if it seemed warranted. With respect to the second change, the clear writing question, it's the bill itself seems unclear and is an illustration of the problem. It's pretty difficult to legislate. For example, what does prior mean? Prior, how far prior? I'm talking about line 29 now. To whom is the rule to be presented? That's not made clear, although one would assume it would be to the same people that was originally published to. What does presented mean? Does it mean republished? Or does it mean simply announcing it orally at a hearing? Another difficulty in presenting a proposed rule or amendment is that the agency does not know what proposed rule or amendment it's going to adopt. Lots of announcements of rulemaking, an intent to have hearings or to solicit views, are to find out what they're going to do to solve a problem. They don't really know what that rule is going to be until they've obtained these views. Or well, they don't want to be put on the spot of having made up their mind.
Having ascertained what you think the views are, why you can't hold a hearing to get the total reaction to it?
I think this would depend on the controversial degree of the problem. If you solicited views and they were all one way and you decided to go along with it, there would perhaps be no need for a hearing.
It'd be a very unusual procedure in the legislature for us to pass bills without holding hearings.
Well, I can understand that, but there are lots of agency bills, or bills, rules, that are adopted without a hearing as long as they afford the opportunity to be heard. A lot of very routine rules that just aren't controversial. This, I think, is what Senator Halleck's bill speaks to, this Senate Bill 171, which we have scheduled for Wednesday, and where he is, in effect, asking that all rules be as a result of a hearing.
Well, we decide what's routine and what's not. If we decided which bills were routine and which were not, there's an awful lot of legislation we could pass without ever hearing from the public.
I understand that, Senator. I think what the agencies attempt to do is through the announcements and through these many hundred that we send out is to find out from the public, is it controversial? Do 25 or more people come forth and ask for a hearing? I don't think we have any strong feeling about the 25 people figure that was chosen by the Attorney General. If that were reduced, I don't think we would make any difference to it. Another question in our mind is whether or not an unclear rule is invalid. In other words, we think this would lead to a great deal of litigation, that there would be, that there could very well be a lot of court actions brought stating that a given rule is invalid because it's not clearly written. If the bill were adopted, I would think the language at the very end, former paragraph 5, now 7, should be looked at because it says no rule adopted after September 9, 71 is valid unless adopted in compliance with this section. That would put a series of rules into question that weren't clearly written from that date until this. I don't want to take more time making a talk. We're opposed to it because we don't think it's necessary. If it is adopted, we think it should be more carefully and more clearly drafted.
Questions of Mr. Peterson?
First, I'd appreciate if we could add your suggested amendments to the situation in writing. And then I'd like to ask the former witness, Mr. Panofsky, if his people have had any difficulty with the gentleman's department, they're confident in the problems he spoke about prior to the other department.
Senator Hoyt, as a matter of fact, no. We wish every state agency would respond to the input we have at hearings, the Workman's Council Board, as they do. There's one current, as a matter of fact, on what's called the Second Injury Fund, an administrative rule. There was a considerable amount of testimony. The Workman's Comp Board took that testimony into consideration and, as a matter of fact, held a second hearing just the other day. Now, unfortunately, we don't get that kind of response from many of the other state agencies.
Jack, who actually put pen to paper on this rule?
charges on.
Who wrote this rule? Your bill.
Who wrote the bill, Senator?
Right.
His name is Rich in Legislative Council. I'm sorry, his last name escaped me.
You have somebody sponsor it for you down there?
Yes.
Did you suggest the wording?
No, as a matter of fact, the bill that we originally requested was suspected very strongly to be unconstitutional, and this was a substitute to our original request.
Thank you. Further questions, Mr. Peterson?
So, Madam Chairman, I want to exploit the opportunity just now being here. You asked me what I wanted to do, and I'd like to know how we can adopt this, force the rest of these agencies to use the same procedures that these people are, and make Christians on all of them.
Let's hear from Mr. Mowery to get further on the subject.
He might have a more general response to that, Senator, than I would.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you very much.
Mr.
Well, I told her that I couldn't leave yet.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Al J. Lowy, L-A-U-E. I'm an Assistant Attorney General assigned to the Appellate Division. I'm appearing before this committee on Senate Bill 184, neither in opposition or otherwise, but with some suggestions. My function in the Attorney General's office, among other things, has been to generally advise the agencies on the Administrative Procedure Act. In the 1971 session, the Attorney General assigned me to, as a liaison between the agencies and the Bar Committee and the legislature, for passing the rather extensive revision of the Administrative Procedure Act, Chapter 183, which appeared as House Bill 1213 of the 1971 session. Thereafter, according to and pursuant to the requirements of House Bill 1213, the Attorney General's model rules were drafted under the Administrative Procedure Act, which agencies may adopt or may not adopt. And in response to an earlier question, I would estimate 80-85% of the agencies have adopted, some with special modifications, the model rules, some with special modifications to fit their particular circumstances.
Did the Department of Labor or DEQ adopt them?
I cannot tell you for sure, Senator. I will be back on 171, and I will be prepared to provide you with a complete list. Secretary of State maintains a list of who does adopt them. Subsequent to the adoption of Attorney General's model rules under the Administrative Procedure Act, which is this document, the Attorney General's direction, we held at Lincoln City on the coast last June an administrative hearing institute. I have here a copy of the material that was presented at that institute.
Are you going to meet that for me?
Yes, I have sufficient that I can provide additional copies for each member. I do think, in a way, in line with Senator Hoyt's questioning, I'm well aware how much material you people have to go through, but I think this can give you at least an idea of what we advise the agencies to do and how to proceed under this rather large general law. I have a copy here, Madam Chairman. I can provide others. I'd like to retain one now so I can speak to it, because I can't remember it all.
We would appreciate more.
Yes, I can bring them on Wednesday or send them over earlier than that. Look down it will give you an idea. Now, please let me understand, this does not have the force, Senator, of, as you suggested, making Christians of the agencies. We have to do that on a day-to-day ad hoc basis. An agency can completely ignore it. We consider our function is not, of course, to make their policy decisions, but to advise them in how to operate within the Administrative Procedure Act. This program itself, the speakers were, well, this will give you a general idea. The notice of rulemaking and the notice of adoption of rules was addressed by Mr. Jack Thompson of the Secretary of State's office, which, as was earlier questioned, has basically the publication responsibility under the statute. Form.
That's one of the questions that has bothered us, along with, well, included in Senator Halleck's bill, that we don't feel is adequate notification. Do your model rule address that problem?
Yes, Senator, I would possibly, if you want to look at it.
If you were promulgating a rule regarding beautician, would each beautician in the state receive a notice of hearing?
If you refer to Rule 2 in our model rules, which are in the smaller pamphlet, Notice of Rulemaking, the statute itself only requires publication of the Secretary of State's bulletin, and that's probably as aware to the general public as publication in the legislative calendar is.
What's the circulation of
that? The Secretary of State's bulletin circulates around 1,500. Anyone can get on it.
What does it cost?
Fairly inexpensive, I believe. Attorneys may get to it. Agencies are on it. Various interested personnel. It comes out twice a month.
All attorneys are on it.
No.
3,500.
Yeah, not all attorneys are on it. Major law libraries are completely on it. It's available there. Special interest groups. Mrs. Hansen, actually, of the Secretary of State's office, can give you the specific circulation of the bulletin. Some get
but,
only
but
the.
But actually, it's going to attorneys and law libraries doesn't do a client any good. He doesn't know he needs an attorney. He doesn't know the rules.
We're in complete accord, Senator. That's why, if you'll notice the nature of our notices under the model rules, that's what the legislature required. They didn't go any further with the Secretary of State's bulletin. We felt to solicit input, it would also be advisable, as you will notice, form of notice, United Press, internationally associated press, and such other news media as the agency may deem appropriate, and whenever practicable and appropriate, the agency shall send written notices to each licensee of the agency. We did not want to place into a burden where to send one to every single barber. That might be highly expensive. One that I continually advise the agencies and that we have mentioned. Agencies that regulate special industries, special professions. Usually those agencies or those professions have their own house journal, similar to the Oregon State Bar Journal.
If they don't you know who the officers are?
Pardon?
Don't you know who the officers of the barbers are?
Oh, certainly, and this is another advice we give to the agency. If you have an organization of regulated individuals, you would notify them. If you have a mailing list, which most agencies do, depending upon the size of the mailing list, that are interested in what you do, send it to your mailing list. If it doesn't run to 15,000, send it to your mailing list, send it to your house organ. Use your judgment, and we have found most of them cooperative. The cosmetic therapy, which was an example you would mention, APA and UPI might not pick it up. They might not feel it was general news. But the Journal of Cosmetic Therapy, the Professional Association, all of those will be upon an agency's list of people with whom they are in contact. Recent example, Children's Services Division's mailing on the recent question on the fourth daycare center. Again, we were consulted as to how they should get it out. Naturally, the press was very interested. It was quickly picked up. But the example of their mailing was all interested persons.
You charged them when they consult you?
Does the agency charge? Do I charge when an agency consults me? Usually my questions only take about 5 or 10 minutes to answer. I do not put it down. If they have a heavy specific project, I do will charge possibly a quarter to three quarters of an hour. Just upon this, what's the best way to get your idea across? This session, for instance, was charged for the materials. We did not charge our time to any one agency. It was a project.
Senator John Burns.
Well, Madam Chairman, it seems to me, Mr. Lowey, that in the long run, it would save the state money if you did send out notice to all the licensees. Rather than the way the rule, the model rule is proposed. I have specific reference to some recent rule changes that related to nursing homes. And there's an association of private nursing home operators that were notified, but those homes that didn't belong to the association and didn't subscribe to the Secretary of State's little pamphlet didn't
weren't apprised of it, didn't know anything about it until after the fact, and I don't know whether there's going to be litigation, I don't know whether there's going to be another hearing or what, but simply because of the fact that people didn't get notice, there's in the very least going to be a whole lot more administrative time and taken up and money spent, and would it really be that owner that each
licensee
is notified?
Senator Burns, I couldn't answer your questions. I would have to answer the agency by agency. If I am called by an agency saying, who do we notify, I will say, okay, use your administrative judgment. Certainly you want to let everybody know. The very comments you have made would be my advice. On the other hand, I can't speak and don't speak for the particular agency. An agency may well come in and say, I've got 15,000, say, licensees.
Why would you have that many?
All right, I don't know. I'm just putting a figure out of the air. Motor vehicles. Suppose you said everybody, there's one.
Okay, motor vehicles.
Gain commission. I don't know. I can't speak for the agency. I don't have that statistic. But I could ask the agencies, again, or you could ask the agencies, could you send it to every licensee? But DEQ may not have a licensee, so then you would still have your problem.
But they must have a pretty good idea who's got a potential license.
That's what we have to leave. That's what I advise leaving to administrative judgment. Now, the judgment of different administrators is not. Our advice to them consistency is let people know. Don't rely just on the Secretary of State's bulletin. And I think if you will examine this that we presented to them, you will find that that has been our strong advice. Try to get it out so people can get the input and talk to you about your rule.
Well, that's another question, Madam Chairman. Is it so much a matter of administrative judgment as a matter of legal judgment? And should not the question of notice perhaps be something uniformly promulgated not by the agency, but by the legal arm.
Putting me in one imbalance between one side or the other, I'm supposed to say to what I'm supposed to draw by rule a piece of legislation. I can say, okay, as far as practicable, I can't know. Our office can't know the detailed workings of each specific agency. So we feel, okay, we'll trust them, let them make their policy judgment, advise them of what they're going to face, such as your example on the nursing home project, advise them, and if they have made their judgment that they don't want to and face the subsequent additional hearing, and we will try to support them as we would any other client. We give them our best advice, but ultimately their decision is theirs to make.
And to keep breath.
It seemed to me like this could have all well been handled by administrative heads using common sense, and they haven't. And that's why we got the problem back here. This thing that the Secretary of State sends out, quite a voluminous thing, and you yawn when you start opening it up. It's boring, and very few people see it. If we made them give the same notice as if you're going to sue somebody, it's out of state and published in the Data Journal of Commerce, it'd be just as bad. I don't know how you handle it, but I know the agencies aren't doing it. I remember the Marine Board, I've been discussing about these speedboats going up and down the Willamette River. Every time one did, I get about 16 phone calls from constituents. And I'm going to stop that from happening. And so I'm in a case of correspondence with the Marine Board for a year and a half trying to do something the legislature last session told them to do. And they had a hearing and didn't even notify me. And it would seem to me if I had written 10 letters and let the state representative of the district know about it, they would have a hearing. So I know they're not using good sense about it. And it seemed to me they could handle it, but they haven't. And that's why we got this bill here today.
What sanctions, Senator, I might ask you, are you going to impose? The last session imposed a sanction that a rule that was not adopted in substantial compliance with the requirements of 183, and the 183 requires that notice be given, would be invalid. I concur with you completely. It's up to the common sense and judgment of the agencies. Now, not to use a cliche, but can we legislate common sense? All we can do is try to encourage the agencies to view their function. Please also, the Administrative Procedure Act although having been in for a long time, only since the 71 session has it been of such broad applicability and awareness. That's why we held this session. Now, we could not force the agencies. We couldn't charge them. We said, come on over. We'll provide you, as interestingly as possible, with material about how you work and live with this item. That's the only way is to persuade, get yourself a good administrator and let him run. One agency that I'm very familiar with that has worked under the Administrative Procedure Act since its inception many years ago is Corporation Commission. As for conciseness, I think maybe somebody read that even Frank Healy had problems when an editorial on the gobbledygook on his rule on the qualifications of broker salesmen. It is a problem, even if the best administrator. We can encourage them. You certainly can legislate and require. The problem we face on the other side, that I listen to from the agencies, is one of the biggest beasts that we don't respond quickly enough. So we try to help them to move as fast as possible. Secretary of State's bulletin, for instance, takes a 10-day lead time before publication. You can't take anything until any action until 20 days after publication. Publication is the 1st and the 15th. How do you make the judgment of how much hearing as to notification of the public? All due respect, I sat here and listened to you discussing downstairs the relative responsibility law. A couple of the witnesses testified to you. How do we know this is going on? I heard about it an hour ago. I'm sure the legislature makes just as much in a sincere effort to get it out to the interested people. But also, interested people, I would suggest to this committee and to the agencies, and do suggest, interested people who are regulated by an agency also have some responsibility themselves to keep themselves aware. I'll admit.
What if they notified the agency that they wanted notice any time?
If an agency said to me that we have a letter from Mr. Jones who said, I want notice any time that you adopt, amend, or repeal a rule, I would say you'd be darn sure that that's the individual you send it to. And I would say that if such notice were not sent, I might have a little trouble upholding the rule as adequate notice if it gets challenged in the Court of Appeals. Maybe not. I mean, we get to the merits of the issue of what the interested person would present. That's possibly an idea, a way of legislation. Anyone who is placed upon an agency mailing list is entitled to receive notification personally.
Going specifically to this bill, the person sets forth adequate reasons for needing additional time. Do you see any reason why I shouldn't have?
No objections to it, and I would say as a matter of practice, again, if we are asked, the advice would be certainly extend time. As far as the notice requirements are concerned, I'd have to again pick up my tools and see what particular use of the tool, that is Chapter 183, could be made. I would probably
analogizing it to a court proceeding. You just give notice to those persons who are there that you're extending the time. One would assume you have the interested parties before you.
But that's your problem, because and that's the problem that creates in this rulemaking in particular, is that very analogy. We've tried to tell the agency to make two distinctions in the Administrative Procedure Act on analogy. If you will go to the notice of rulemaking in this little volume, I think we gave them a rubric, quite break the rule of thumb on page 3. If what you are doing strikes you as similar to something that would be either necessary or appropriate for a bill in the legislature, you are probably making a rule. Conversely, if it's analogous to a court case, you are dealing in a contested case matter. Therefore, it comes down to the question in this 184 on line 13, when a party requests additional time to prepare a response. The definition of party in Chapter 183 reads, each person or agency entitled as of right to a hearing before the agency or named or admitted as a party. Party directs itself to the contested case procedure because the contested case procedure follows the court analogy, it being a determination of the relationship between an individual. Rule is more analogous to legislature. As Mr. Peterson said earlier, possibly a suggestion of person, if this is interested person rather than party, because if you insert this into 183, who has a right to be heard? Well, maybe everybody has. All interested members of the public have a right to be heard before a rulemaking hearing.
Well, as I gather, the procedure, as far as it's stated in this bill, not from a thorough reading of 183, after the input is made in the hearing, the agency then promulgates. Then, as I gather, there's no hearing on what they consider their end product. They simply put it into effect.
No, there is not. They have one hearing. If the hearing becomes extensive and they can't get enough data, they may extend their time. Ultimately, the decision has to be made.
Yeah, but they're not putting before them and saying, now we've heard from all of you and that your input, and here it is. This is what we're going to do, like the legislature does.
You've heard from the input. You hold a series of hearings, right? All right, an agency will put out its notice and give what we try to advise at adequate time, within the time that it must also act, to say write to us and give us your views. If that request, and quite frankly, those written views are usually of much more value in the long run than the oral views. But write to us and give us your views, and we will have a public hearing at which you can come and present your views. All right. After that data and material input has been in, there comes a time at which the agency must make a decision. It will usually, as you pointed out beforehand, have something in mind by way of a proposed rule. There may be rare occasions.
You are answering my question.
After the input, no. But there is a remedy, Senator, because any person who, after the rule has been adopted, said, I didn't like your views, I didn't like what you did, anyway, there's a petition for the amendment of a rule which may be easily filed and a tool used, and the agency must act upon that petition. Unlike almost an initiative from the individuals. If the agency adopts the rule and somebody who had the input said, I don't like that particular rule, even though he put in the input, then a petition for an adoption to an amendment of the rule to conform to what he wants is empowered by the Administrative Procedure Act.
Yeah, you know that's unrealistic.
I doubt it's unrealistic, Senator. The problem with the Administrative Procedure Act in the last year or so has been that too few people have utilized the material that is available to them. Within this act. This act is a broad tool and could be used.
It's an uphill battle.
It may be an uphill battle, but not too many people have attempted the battle in my experience. At least the agencies haven't called to our attention. I've advised people. One simple question. The members in the corrections area, members of the bar, have been suggesting that the Oregon State Penitentiary and the Oregon State Correctional Institution adopt certain attorney visitation rules. The agencies themselves have been working on it. I have suggested to four solid members of the bar, why don't you petition the agency for adoption of rules on attorney visitation to residents of those institutions? Every time I write a letter out to the members of the bar who are so interested in the committee, it's just silent. I mean, nobody takes advantage. How do they know it would be an uphill battle if they don't drop in a petition to adopt a rule within their own conformity?
I would like to know, would you apply what you just said to the problem of the Associated General Contractors Workers Bill?
Well, I just heard the problem of the Associated General Contractors when I came in here today. The DE, and I will try, but please understand that I'm just taking it one at a time. As for the Department of Environmental Quality rule, I can only say this, it was probably a big rule. Looking at the timing, at that time in last, at the end of 71, when were Mr. Kalinowski's dates? He was saying, December 1st of 71 was when DEQ started out with a big batch of rules. My recollection, and I may be in error, the DEQ had just received a legislative mandate to get to work upon a problem. Its method, therefore, was to adopt a large mass of rules, a fairly new agency. The workout had been detailed to them. Maybe they did move too fast. I don't know whether requests for extension were made, but I think they're in the horns of a dilemma, too, when they're doing it. The legislature says you shall work out the details of this particular problem. Now, you better do it promptly. But how promptly can you do it when at the same time somebody's saying, well, now, wait a minute, we want to talk about it. Following that example, certainly that was an extensive set of rules. They may should possibly have been better advised to hold an additional hearing, but also they're under the pressure to get those rules enforced so that they can perform their function, so that they can have their tools. Now, again, my suggestion of an amendment to particular rules would stand very good. The Associated General Contractors come in and say, we don't like this for these reasons. Why don't you amend it? And our advice to DEQ would be, give that solid consideration and make a determination from this input whether or not you should amend that rule as requested. And I believe they would follow it. It's there. These tools are available. This act has only come into awareness among the bar and the public within the last year and a half. And as it goes on, it was originally drafted to be made as a useful tool to make agencies responsive. And I think they can. And I feel that they have. Sure, some people have bad experiences with agencies. We can't, input common sense, but we can certainly encourage it and try to inform the agencies of their function.
Send the keep for us.
Do you think 20 days is a reasonable time? Look at that rule that Mr. Saldowski had up there.
He said he didn't impose
an extension.
I'm just wondering whether an initial time of 20 days is that.
As a minimum, Senator Burns, yes, on the basis that they would in a more complex exposed. 20 days, the reason I like the 20 days is because I don't want them invoking the temporary rule too fast. Remember, the temporary rule gives them, without prior hearing, 120 days effectiveness. Now, you come again, Senator, with this dilemma. Come on, agency, respond. Well, I can't respond because it takes me a month from the 10 days before the publication date to the 20 days I can do something, even though it's a minor matter that everybody is in full accord that I should make a change now promptly. Okay, 20 days is a minimum, with the judgment to say, with the advice to the agency, 20 is your minimum. Go on beyond that. Give plenty of ample time. If you can live with it without having to invoke that temporary rule, which I don't call it emergency because we fought to see to it that it wasn't called, but I don't want to see abuse. Again, as you will see in our material, we make a strong point to them. Do not abuse the temporary rule.
Further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Lowry. I'd like to ask the committee, I have some bills. I have a bill from Betty Roberts, which she has sought the Attorney General advice, and the bill purports to conform our law on abortion to the ruling of the United States Supreme Court. If you'd like to introduce it to the committee, all those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. I have another bill which also is different from Senator Betty Roberts, but it too relates to the abortion decision and purports to conform the law to another portion of its decision. All those in favor of the bill I'm now discussing would delete the necessity of consent of the husband. It's been said that the Supreme Court decision does do that, but it's not clear.
That's the only thing in the second bill.
That's the only thing.
That's Betty's and the broader bill.
That's Betty's and broader.
That's what I heard.
John? Then I have another bill, and I would beg of you to introduce it. It's a no fault auto bill, but I can't remember who gave it to me, so I can't give it back to them unless they agree to use it.
Number four? Number four or five?
Five, I think. Thank you. We turn to... let's turn to...
to Senate Bill 160. This is that one that allows you to say directly without having to go through a straw man. Keith Burns moves that Senate Bill 160 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Question.
Clerk, call the roll. Jaeger.
Aye.
Haber.
Aye.
Boyd.
Aye.
Take up Senate Bill 134 relating to statute of limitations. Mr. Gronzo? Senator, the music sits on your right if you care.
I'll tell him how to vote.
Okay.
We asked Mr. Gronzo about the pinning of the bar pole. No, we won't.
Go ahead whenever you want to, Mr. Gronzo.
Members of the Senate Judiciary, my name is Wendell Gronzo.
I am a lawyer from Burns, Oregon, and I would like to appreciate the opportunity to comment upon Senate Bill 134, which generally relates to cleaning up the statute of limitations mess that we have in Oregon. For example, at the present time, if you have a hangnail rising out of an accident, suit must be filed within 2 years, but if there's $100,000 property damages, you have 6 years. And I think that the first portion of Senate Bill number 134 is certainly desirable, making a more or less uniform statute of limitations of 3 years in all cases. And I have had occasion to know where individuals let a statute run on a personal injury because they had information from some prior knowledge that the statute of limitations was 6 years when they had a bent fender. So I think that, and I see no real reason to distinguish between property damage and personal injury. And I think that 3 years is a real good compromise for everything. And I also believe that by extending the personal injury portion of it to 3 years, it will in some instances allow a case to be settled that would have otherwise have been filed, because where injuries in some instances just can't be determined the permanency or the nature or the extent of them in 2 years. And I have myself filed cases that were later settled after the medical reports came in. But as to the 7-year limit after the wrongful act or omission, I think that this portion of the bill is a very dangerous thing, in particular in products liability. Our office handled a case on a grinding wheel a few years back where the machine that ran the grinding wheel was manufactured in 1949 and it had a great big heavy guard over the grinding wheel, which is required by law and makes good sense. In 1965, which is 16 years later, the first grinding wheel that had ever been on that machine exploded. In other words, the first that had been used for many years, but had never had any grinding wheel explode. Well, the guard came off when the wheel exploded, and a man got fragments of grinding wheel in his face, and he was horribly and permanently injured with very severe brain damage. Well, this guard was held on. It was a big, heavy-looking guard. To look at it, it was very adequate, but it was held on with a little tin clip down around the shaft where no one would ever look at it. And the first time that the guard really came into use, the reason it was put on there, it just flew off out through the air. There are many, many things. We're living in such a mechanical world, and things are getting more sophisticated and more dangerous, our gadgets, every day. An automobile, if you have a new car and it sheds the front wheel because of a flaw in the metal, no question somebody is injured, no question about it, the manufacturer is liable. But this bill, if the car were manufactured, say it's a 1966 car and was, well, be 1966 car manufactured in August of 1967 car and was manufactured in August of 1966, the person be injured today because of the dangerous inherent defect in that car that hadn't shown up. They weren't out of the hospital by the time the 7 years was up, they would be barred. And with no way whatsoever to discover the defect that caused the injury or the death before the defect actually showed up. And there's many, many things, maybe not as much an automobile as there is your heavy equipment that is built for theoretically a little longer life. And it looks as if and there's very little of this type of manufacturing done in the state of Oregon. It certainly looks as if
this bill is protecting the out-of-state manufacturers at the expense of our citizens. And I would urge that the committee delete the 7-year rule because it's just absolutely unfair and so silly that if the machine fails with the absolute 7-year, if there's a serious injury, they're probably not going to talk to a lawyer or even think about their rights against some third party for 6-7 months later, in many instances, or even a year. So in effect, you're saying that anything maybe 6 years old, there just isn't any remedy. Suppose if there's a winery that has some arsenic on the grapes and the wine is sold to a third party and it's aged for 7 years, then bottled and put on the market. And because it is a vintage wine, should the person who negligently put something like this on the market, and it is supposed to, it's a 1963 vintage, just bottled and sold that way. And it seems to me that we just have too many things that that don't have a chance to do their dirty work until after this period of time. And if under our law, the product has to be defective at the time it leaves the hands of the manufacturer before the manufacturer or wholesaler, retailer, whatever it may be, would be liable. But if it is defective, and it's a hidden and latent defect and doesn't come into play until after that, a seatbelt on an automobile, for example. Maybe the car's never been in an accident, there's never been a strain put on the seatbelt, but there is, they use a plastic bolt instead of a steel bolt, and the first time the car was in an accident, it's 7 years old, and somebody is horribly mangled. I would urge that the committee redo the last half of paragraph 1 so that the manufacturer's dangerous products do not escape just by the mere passage of time before the injuries that happen to occur.
Do you have a question, sir?
I do.
Well, two or three things. But first, Mr. Pronto, you're saying, in effect, that with regard to that 7-year thing, that you think that we shouldn't repeal the first subsection 12.115, is that right, the 10-year rule down there?
Well, I think that the 10-year rule should be also... no, it should be repealed. What this is doing is shortening up one that already, I mean, why should the manufacturer of a heavy piece of machinery, a Caterpillar tractor, for example,
you want it repealed?
I would think so, yes. Now, which number were you?
12.115, it's in the inner column. Down at the bottom right there.
Yes. Well, now this bill was passed.
That's repealed by this.
Mm-hmm. And I think it should be.
You think it should be? Okay. Then you just don't want any limitation whatsoever.
Certainly. Your 2-year rule from the time the injury is inflicted. Because if the article that caused the damage has gone past its life expectancy, the injured party certainly is not going to be able to prove that the culprit machine or gadget was defective when it left the hands of the manufacturer. So they have the protection there in any event. But since our manufactured products do vary so much in their life expectancy, that what would be fair for one certainly wouldn't be fair for the other, and the burden is on the injured party to prove that the defect was built into the thing rather than something that has arisen by somebody else tinkering with it, or poor maintenance, or lack of maintenance,
Well, what, I guess what I'm getting at is, what's the rule on products law? I mean, I agree with you, but what's the present rule by which these latent defects are cut off? They're not cut off.
I think that 12.115 is applicable at this time, isn't it?
No eventually action for negligence and injury be commenced more than 10 years from the date of the act or initiated.
Yes. Until that was passed in 1967, we did not have a statute of limitations, and it was just 2 years from the date of the injury.
Okay. Well, then I have one other question, Mr. Chairman. I'm a little bit surprised that you would favor cutting down the statute from 6 to 3 on trespass cases. Now, put it in perspective, I had the Martin fire case, which was a range fire, where my client had several thousand acres burned. It went to the Supreme Court on the question. We contended that it was trespass, and a railroad contended it was tort. The Supreme Court said it was trespass, and the 6-year statute governed. In your area, a lot of ranches and situations which could be vulnerable to this same sort of thing, you can't really get an assessment of your damage on the rehabilitation of that rangeland in 2 or 3 years. And it would just seem to me that there's a whole lot of merit in having a longer statute for the plaintiff. The injured party would be in a better position to argue damages to cut it down to 3.
Yes. The first thing is, this last fall, the Supreme Court decided that if the man comes on the place with your permission and burns your barn down, it is a 2-year statute of limitations. I can't recall the name of the case, but since they said he wasn't trespassing because he was on there with the permission.
Yeah, but this was a fire that was started on a right away and spread.
Yes, I realize that. But here is the thing that I think that having some uniformity, now some lawyer really feels silly if this case came down on with the barn burning case. I can't, anybody help me on the name of the case? I'm certain that you've all read it. Fact, the case was that the owner of the land was allowing somebody to use his barn to do something, and they negligently burned the barn. And the case was filed more than 2 years after the barn burned, and the Supreme Court said, well, that's, and they go through a lot of hoopla and say, well, that's tort. And that's not trespass. He wasn't a trespasser. So what I believe that for the sake of uniformity, it's certainly worth it. And now, get to this assessing the damages. My experience is, in the area that I live in, people sometimes come in faster on property damages than they do on personal injuries, or especially on a product case, where they don't necessarily realize that there may be a case. And I think maybe it should be a little longer, but I don't see any more problem with the range fire in assessing damages than I do the bad back, where the doctor says, well, 2 years later, the doctor says, well, he may have to have an operation, but I won't know for another year or 3 years. We'll kind of better just sit on it and see what we do. I don't see it. I've had far more problems with personal injury in assessing the damages within 2 years than I have any property damage case that I've ran into. And
well, it just seemed to me that there was a public policy reason initially when the legislature gave a longer statute for waste or trespass, and I want to be persuaded. I can agree. I can buy the argument on uniformity, and I can also agree with your argument with respect to this product liability thing. I think at least I'm going to vote to change that if we act on the bill. But I've got to be persuaded that public policy considerations as far as waste and trespass should be changed. therefore I would be willing to vote just in favor of uniformity on those kinds of actions.
Well, I would probably say that maybe 4 years would be more equitable, but I can't honestly see where waste and trespass is more serious to the injured party than the loss of an arm or an eye. It seems real inconsistent to me that the personal injury has 2 years or the property damage or waste or trespass has 6 years. I think they should all be the same. Now, I could well argue, and I could argue in favor of the first portion of this bill, I believe, with a little more zest if it said 4 years, but for uniformity, in other words, in my experience, I just can't make a logical distinction between the personal injury and the property damage. If any reason, maybe it ought to be the other way around. In other words, your eyesight or your arm, your hearing and your brains are more important to me than anything I'll ever own.
Any more questions, Mr. Granzo? Thank you for coming, Mr. Granzo.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to.
Is there anybody else here who wants to testify on Senate Bill 134?
Yes, Mr.
Who's saying yes?
Peter Herman.
Okay, Peter, I'm sorry. I should. Mr. Herman, you're here on 134, right? Are you here on that letter that the Attorney General sent us?
Yes, sir.
Did you all see that?
Under.
Was that sent to all, every member of the committee, or?
I gave an original and nine copies I sent to Mr.
Winter. Do you have that? Okay, it's probably in our folder. So where it
is? Okay. Mr. Chairman, my name is Peter Herman. I'm Senior Counsel in the Department of Justice, General Counsel Division. I appear here on behalf of the Attorney General in connection with Senate Bill 134. The Attorney General is not taking a position necessarily for or against the bill. He wrote the letter, which is now before the committee, primarily to advise the committee of what he considers certain rather significant consequences that would flow if the bill were passed. I think the letter speaks for itself. Essentially, I think what the Attorney General is concerned, probably more than anything else, is the status of public lands within the state of Oregon. And by public lands, I don't mean just range lands, for example, but also riverbeds. Every category of public interest in property in the state of Oregon. As we read this bill, it would remove, in Section 2, it would remove the state's immunity from the statute of limitations. The state would be subject to 12050, and therefore it would be barred from bringing action to recover any real property, or for that matter, public rights in real property, by somebody, or this adverse possession would be a good defense to such a suit, let me put it that way.
What you're saying, Mr. Herman, is the same thing that the city attorney for that town downstate said at the last hearing, where he drew the example of the water line. 15 years after the water line was laid, they found out that it was defective or something. If this were to pass, then the city would have been barred by the statute on seeking redress for the defective height. I mean, from your experience with the state as well, because that would bar the state too.
Well, that's would be a contract action for damages and for a defective pipe, I take it.
Yeah,
he was talking about. Well, the Attorney General is not as concerned about that. His feeling is that there are appropriate instances when it's perhaps unfair for the state to proceed against a private individual for damages and not be subject to the statute of limitations like everyone else. And the consequences are more serious where you're talking about the loss of real property or rights in real property than when you're talking about a right to collect damages. And the burden of our letter, I would say, is primarily on the loss of real property or public rights in real property. Oddly, the bill exempts taxes from the application of this bill, which would remove the immunity. I think we would feel easier in our mind if it exempted the real property and public rights in real property instead. Not that we think that taxes shouldn't be collected, but in the one case you're talking about money. The other case you're talking about real property, which is once it's lost, it's gone forever. It's as a resource, it's of considerably more importance and value to the public.
Do you have a question, Senator?
Mr. Herman, I was just wondering, in your second paragraph, the first state land board versus the law sounds valid. Is that the Supreme Court now?
That is the Benton County Circuit Court case that we tried recently, and the court made a judgment in our favor. It is now on appeal to the Supreme Court.
The last word really hasn't been said on that.
Beg pardon?
The last word really hasn't been said on that.
No.
It's been going on for some 30 years. Maybe it'd be a good thing to have this, so that you focus on the private attorneys.
Well, I don't think there are going to be any more sand and gravel, sand and gravel cases. I hope not. But when you think of the perhaps thousands of miles of riverbed throughout the state of Oregon, we would have to be in the position of patrolling all that actively to be sure that nobody was making a claim under right, some kind of right to ownership of the bed. If we didn't patrol it, and this bill were in effect, we could conceivably lose sections of riverbed to claimants who were claiming that an avulsion occurred and that they owned the riverbed where the river was now. And unless we actively patrol those situations, we could lose a lot of valuable trust property with a bill like this. The Cavallo Sand and Gravel case is an unfortunate example of inaction on the part of public officers. But the question that the Attorney General would raise is, why should the inaction or negligence or nonfeasance of a public officer penalize the public? Because really, it's the welfare of society you're talking about here, and this bill would affect favorably perhaps an individual in a particular case, but it would be at the expense of society, a permanent loss of real property, for example. As we say, we're not as concerned about the case of damages, because if the state doesn't bring a suit to recover money damages within an appropriate limitation period, all right. The state's out that money, and perhaps the benefits to the individual and not being sued after a great lapse of time outweigh the loss of money. But when you're talking about the loss of real property, a vital state resource of value to the public, I don't think that same consideration can be argued in favor of the bill.
Any other questions, Mr. Chairman? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Jack Kalanowski, Chairman.
Yes. I'd like to testify on 134 as well.
Well, okay, I'll tell you what I did. I didn't look at the list, and Mr. Kalanowski was really signed up first, and I called Mr. Herman out of order, and I apologize.
I'm used to waiting, Mr. Chairman. I'm here to testify on behalf of the Oregon Construction Industry Council in favor of Senate Bill 134. I don't really care to get into a discussion about the merits of having uniform statute of limitations. I think the main thing I'd like to do, Mr. Chairman, is to clear up perhaps a misunderstanding that occurred at the first hearing that I was informed about. I unfortunately had a conflict, couldn't be here. The misunderstanding I'm referring to has to do with the 1971 Act, which is now incorporated into ORS 12.135. That particular bill, 1971 bill, was introduced at our request because our counsel was not clear as to whether or not ORS 12.115 adequately covered the instance where contractors or those affected or those involved in the construction of a project would be involved. We felt a need to have a statute of limitations with regard to the construction industry and the construction industry in total. The problem was, at that particular point in time, what the phrase date of the act or omission complained of, that is in ORS 12.115, actually meant. Now, it wasn't until after the 1971 session adjourned, and our bill, incidentally, was enacted, which gave us a 10-year statute of limitations, that the Oregon Supreme Court decided a case, which I cite for the record, is number 9752. It was decided on December 1, 1971, and it was Jones and Joseph's I don't know, somebody else. Bear, B-E-A-R, et al. Are the defendants.
What's the citation?
9752, is that the number you're asking for?
Well, you don't have the advance sheet there, do you?
No, I'm sorry, I don't. I have a copy of the opinion of Justice Holman. 9752, dated December 1, 1971. And the only thing I'd like to point out in this is that it did relate to a construction problem, and the issue was, I think, 18 years old before it was brought to trial. Now, the Justice Holman referred to this 1971 Act by saying this: it would not have been logical for the groups affected by the 1971 enactment to stand by and take a chance on the construction which this court would give, subsection 1 of ORS 12.115, when the matter could be foreclosed for the future by legislative enactment. In other words, that says very clearly what our concern was and why we went after the 1971 Act. The other thing I'd like to just like to point out, Mr. Chairman, is that the average statute of limitations with respect to the construction industry throughout the United States seems to be 6.5 years. We have a bill over on the House side at the present time which amends our 1971 Act, asking for a period of 5 years. We're waiting to see what happens with Senate Bill 134. We've asked the committee chairman, Mr. Cole, Representative Cole, to hold up on our bill if awaiting a decision by this committee and the Senate on Senate Bill 134. The only thing I would ask, I suppose, is that perhaps something be done on this bill so we can take whatever action we feel is necessary on the House side.
I'm sure we'll do something.
I'm sure you will.
Now, this is the bill we talked about the other day that has to do with contractors and architects' liability.
Right, right. I think the finger was inadvertently pointed to the wrong lobbyist.
I was talking about my colleague, and he said it wasn't. I was pretty sure it was.
Yeah.
Any other questions of Galanowski? Thank you, Jack. Did Mr. Enfield leave?
Yes.
Because of the related nature of testimony, I'm going to call on Mr. Swink next, Bill, if you don't mind. Mr. Grozel from Burns was here and testified.
Already.
Also.
I wish to apologize to Mr. Don Swink from Portland. I practice law in this state and have for some years. Excess of 20, I'm afraid. I was unfortunately delayed and couldn't hear everybody's testimony. I know the proponent's testimony the other day. There are two or three items that I think should be called to the committee's attention. The last gentleman who testified was talking about a section of the statute that now exists that is not affected by this Bill 134, as I read
it. I think it repeals that.
It doesn't say that it does.
Well,
it goes to 12130, and this is 12135 that he was speaking of.
I thought he said about 12115.
Well, he speaks of 115, but he also spoke of 135, which is the construction industry.
Okay. I thought he talked about that.
It isn't referred to as being one of the sections repealed.
All right.
I would like to first address myself to the question of switching off of the 10-year period that is referred to in the initial statute and so widely changed under 12140. The concern that, as an attorney representing the general public, that I have, and since I have specialized in the field of products liability for a number of years, there is a definite concern where a product fails. I had a case submitted to me by an insurance carrier recently that wished to recover for the death of a workman for their benefit, that which they'd paid out, as well as for the widow. It involved a piece of machinery that had been designed by an engineer and constructed by a concern in Minnville, a reputable steel fabricating concern, where it was for the purpose of building stress forms for these steel-reinforced concrete girders. And particular piece of machinery required a number of plates of steel to be put together, and uniformly over the United States, the material on it requires that the one sheet be buried in the other. In other words, a trench dug in the sheet and that it be buried and then welded together. This was not done, and this piece of machinery gave away. It had been in existence for many years, too, but when the fault came and the experts examined the materials, the failure was due to this thing not being properly constructed, not in the failure of the material itself. Had we had less than a 10-year statute of limitations on something of this kind, we would have been experiencing difficulty. The other thing that concerns me very, very much is the change in terminology. I'd call your attention to the third line of 1240, where it says the injury is not discoverable within 2 years of the act. I have questioned any number of lawyers that handle both defense and claimants work on this kind of thing. Nobody seems to know what the word discoverable is supposed to mean. The statute has always read from the date of discovery or when it was discovered or in the exercise of reasonable care, as is shown later in your thing. I think this is a correction that under any circumstances, any change is most necessary to be made. The confusion that would be created both for litigants, their representatives in the courts, would be insurmountable if this was permitted. I think there's much to commend extending the general statute of limitations for tort liability from 2 years to 3 years, as is done in this statute. I think this is a good thing. The amendment or deletion of that material, the limitations of that material applying to, for example, the medical profession, which was so carefully drawn, I'm not sure that this is a good thing to delete. I think it gives them certain protections to which they may be well entitled. I'm concerned, however, about reducing times to 7 years. I think particularly of legal malpractice, which isn't covered specifically in the act as a medical profession. Certainly, those of us who practice law are not without human error at times, and suppose we made an error on a will and it wasn't discovered for a number of years. I think that this reduction to 7 years from 10 would be wrong. I think it would be detrimental to the general public, and I think we have a responsibility to be exposed at least to that period of time.
This is the section that deals with medical responsibility.
It doesn't repeal it, but it changes it quite materially. 12.110, which is one of the sections which is repealed, subsection 4, provides that an action to recover damages for injuries to persons arising from any medical, surgical, or dental treatment, omission, or operation shall be commenced within 2 years from the date when the injury is first discovered, or in the exercise of reasonable care should have been discovered, provided that such section shall be commenced within 5 years from the date of the treatment, omission, or operation upon which action is based, or if there has been no action commenced within 5 years because of fraud, deceit, or misleading representation, then within 2 years from the date of such fraud. The reason for this fraud business is because of a case that I handled in I can't remember the county now, doesn't make any difference, some years ago, where there had been a concealment to some degree of the fact that a mistake had been made. And as a matter of fact, I had an allied case some years later that where some attorneys had made a mistake, and they were seeking the protection of the statute of limitations too, and the deceit section was held up.
Is that your fault, is leading the 12.110?
Well, I think that the language of that section specifically applicable to the medical profession has some merit to it. It would not hurt if it went to the 7 years instead of the five that it has in subsection 4 of 110, in my opinion. I think that uniformity would be helpful.
Another question, Mr. Freak? If you have any suggestions on amendments or anything, a good person to call with respect to the committee is Mr. John DeWinter, who's sitting there on the immediate right, who's the counsel for the committee.
Fine.
No indication.
Thank you very much. I didn't have an opportunity to prepare a written text to give you. If it is desired, I would be more than happy to do so and set it down.
I would think it'd probably be helpful to members of the committee. It's essential.
Well, it'd be very brief. I don't think that there's any point in belaboring a bunch of things, but if there's some points that could be helpful, I'd be glad to send them on.
Thank you. Appreciate you coming down.
Thank you.
The other, let's see, Bill Cox, you're the only other one signed up on 134.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you, Bill, for
out of order, and excuse me for calling you in order. I didn't have a chance to.
Mr. Chairman, I'm members of the committee. I'm Bill Cox, Director of the Division of State Land. And really, my purpose in speaking on Senate Bill 134 is to acquaint you with a problem of a state landholding trustee that has trust of large acreages of unsurveyed land. And to acquaint you with the aspect of Senate Bill 134, which takes the state from underneath the statute of limitations. The basic problem is that the state holds, as an example, as do certain other agencies, such as state forestry, large acreages of lands that are essentially unsurveyed. We hold them by section alone, two sections out of each township and range, surrounded by either federal property or private property. We are in the effort now of trying to combine these properties into manageable units. But at this particular point, we do not have them combined, and it's a long process between ourselves, the federal government, and private individuals to so block them. in order to be sure that someone is not trespassing on our land and in such a manner that could invoke the adverse possession defense to a trespass action, we would have to, number one, survey, have our land surveyed, and number two, have the ability to cover them within the period of time of the statute of limitations, be sure that there was no one on them. This becomes sometimes very difficult, especially within forest lands, forested areas, and within the large acreages in eastern Oregon. And Mr. Herman also mentioned the problems within the waterways, and I'm not referring further to that, but I wanted to go on record that the division was opposed to Senate Bill 134 as it applies to this limitation or lifting the governmental immunity in this area.
Any questions, Mr. Cox? Thanks, Bill. Is there anybody else here who wants to testify on Senate Bill 134? All right. Now we've got let's see, on Senate Bill 36. Bill Cox on here, Mr. Fuji, Mr. Hathaway. Where are you from, Mr. Hathaway? Okay, and Mr. Hogan's here from the governor's office, is that right?
Yes.
What I'm inclined to do is take Mr. Hathaway's testimony and then reschedule in 36 for the rest of them if there's no objection on the part of the committee. Otherwise, we've got to bring Mr. Senator Meeker up here. We're going to be here for another hour, so we'll have another committee meeting. So, Mr. Hathaway, why don't you give us your testimony, and then we're going to continue Senate Bill 36 till the next session or whatever the chairman's wishes are, John.
My name is Roy Hathaway.
Excuse me just a second. Pardon me, ma'am.
I was going to say, I wanted to sign the witness list, too, and I didn't.
Are you here on 36?
Yes.
And you're from where?
I'm from Paulsley.
Well, that's fine. We'll take
but
your testimony.
I'm sure that he'll say what I want said, so I won't say it.
Well, you're welcome to testify if you want to today. If anybody that came from...
Well, I just like to go on record. I'm Mrs. George Van Lewis from
Paulsley. Don't you get on here? Excuse me.
Safe to see?
Yeah.
My name is Roy Hathaway. I'm from Benton County. I'm a landowner in the Willamette River bottom. I favor the concept of this Senate Bill 36. I feel that this concept is one way to get the title along the Willamette River, the main Willamette River stem, settled. Now each lot and parcel of land along the Willamette River creates separate problems. Just because you settle the issue on one lot or one parcel of land doesn't necessarily settle it on one right adjacent to it with an identical problem. We have, in our own case, we had one parcel of land go clear to the Supreme Court to settle ownership. It's a cut and dried case as to what it actually settles, and yet we go up on another parcel of land that has identical situation. The title company says they can't give us title on this until this particular piece of land is settled in court. Each parcel has to be settled in court. The cost of settling these things under these conditions is prohibitive for as far as landowners along the Willamette River. Maybe some kind of a class action could be initiated and settle a lot of them at once, but as of now, this type of thing hasn't happened. We recently tried to get a land bank loan on a parcel of land which includes several lots. The title company wouldn't give us a title to this, wouldn't guarantee us a title to this land, so and therefore it clouded the title and we couldn't get a loan on this particular piece of land. And other problems as you go back into the history of the river, how do you establish what was an avulsive channel? I mean, this becomes a real hassle. Maybe it can be done, but it's a real battle to establish an avulsive channel in 1876, for instance. To me, a proper solution to this would be an amendment to this bill that would state now and forever, that land...
Are you aiming at any specific place in the bill?
No, I'm just giving it out as general information. It would be state that what the river flows over would belong to the state. And the part that it doesn't flow over would belong... In other words, give the state of Oregon the channel that the river runs over, wherever it runs and whenever it runs there. And that would solve the problem from now on. It would hurt some, it would help some, but I think it's an equitable solution.
Another question?
Yeah, I'm interested in your solution, right? Suppose the river moves over on your place.
That's tough.
Well, now, would the part you lost, the crew, the person that owned the other side of the bank?
Certainly.
If you have a gain, you'd have a loss.
That's right.
But at least you know where you're at.
Right.
That's what you're asking.
Right. With this Greenway concept coming in, now they say that they don't want anything to do with the revetment. They say if the water wants to wash the bank away, why, let's let it do it naturally. You want to look at this natural thing. This river goes away from an area, and then the state or the Greenway will claim a parcel of land here where it washed from, and I see a real problem developing here in this type of a thing. But, to me, this is just a logical solution to the problem.
Another question, Mr. Hathaway? Thank you very much, Hathaway. Let's see. Mrs. Van Leeuwen, did you want to testify? I just wanted to...
The same as here, almost.
Okay. Mr. Turnage, you're from where?
Albany.
What's going on?
I really don't have anything to testify, but I'd like to ask some questions while these guys are here concerning this bill. I'm also a landowner on the river, and I got lots of questions. But number one is, on section 2, on 29, it says division means division of state lands. And as I understand this bill, the division will determine which of these lands are... All these, where they shifted on this thing, and I don't know whether there's anybody from the land board here or where they're at, but who are these people that are going to make this determination to submit to the individual counties that it speaks of down here on?
May I suggest that you have a session with Mr. Cox over there? I'm sure he'd do that now. He's the director of state land board, and
my fear is that we have. Bureaucrats.
Oh, you've got bureaucrats.
And it's going to come there and get this thing all fixed, and then we're going to have a fight in 1976 on their decision. And that's why on this bill. Because, and as Mr. Hathaway said, I have lands that I either want the river or the old river bed, one or the other. I'd prefer the river today.
I suggest this. Why don't you talk to Mr. Cox and then... What you learn about this bill, the parts you're in favor of or opposed to, you need to come back and testify, or you can write us a letter based on it after you get your questions answered.
All right.
Is that all right?
Fine. Great.
Yeah, I just want to be sure, Mr. DeWitter, doesn't Section 12 answer this question to go to court?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, but that's after it's been posted.
You don't come back to legislation and go to court.
That's what I don't want. Because then you've got a cost. See, it doesn't state there. Of a Carvalho sand and gravel. The next thing that I would make a testimony on the minority report. Have you guys read the minority report that Mr. Bach, whoever he is, I don't know, that made? Is a lot simpler and less costly, in my opinion, than this method that this Senate Bill 36 presents.
Are you here from Albany?
Yes.
That's in the Meeker District. No. Did I reach out that far? No.
It's a matter of quitclaim deeds, as you probably know, that it's Mr. Hathaway's suggestion, too, that we clarify this without all this litigation and legal entanglements that I foresee in this Senate Bill 36.
Okay, is that procedure satisfactory?
That's fine.
Okay,
I'd like to know when the thing is. Sometimes it's hard to find
when
the hearings
are.
Are
we going to take this up next time, John, or finish it up, or do you think?
No, we would have to... We've already rescheduled for next week.
Well, you have.
We'll have to reschedule this. It'll be after next week. Fine time.
No problem. You just let me know. Will it be in this
published.
Okay.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
I'll give your name to the clerk.
Oh, we got it here.
Okay.
Oh,
thank you.
Mr. Turner, just give me your address and put it
Rock 2, Box 169, Albany. Is that doing the job you want me to do?
Yeah, that's doing it. And then we'll, then the clerk will send you a notice. Is that right, Terry?
Okay.
You're all taken care of then. All right, the rest of the witnesses are from Salem, and if it's satisfactory, why, we'll hear your testimony week after next. Now, Mr. Lowe, are you here on any particular legislation? Everybody else is happy? Okay, we're adjourned.
161 relating to conveyances of real property. Say bar bill.
Yes.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Oh, let's see. Senator Ivers pointed out that he was calling on line 20 of page 2. Did you correct that?
We still need to correct that, Madam Chair.
Senator Ivers, would you care to spell please for us?
Where are we talking about?
161.
Can't spell it. You don't get this. There's any more amendments.
That isn't the word I was talking about.
Well, I was going to say, I don't know if you can spell it now. There's one on 24.
That's?
The
D. No, that was just an addition, but.
Yeah.
I. Let's see.
I mean, he doesn't see. Oh, five.
Wrong word, isn't it? I don't remember my train of thought on it at all right now. Maybe I think about it. I think it was.
Well,
the insertion of the word Z on line 24 is what I had.
Senate Bill 137. this also as a...
This one, Senator Brent
has
particular
interest, and
I think he does. Is this the one where
he's
running his state?
No, that's Senate Bill
134. Yeah.
Madam Chairman.
But wasn't there something, this connection with Senate Bill 141 or something we were going to...
Yeah, I have a note here.
We're going to combine it or do something? or should be?
I have a note on Senate 141.
We were supposed to be thinking about combining it.
Madam Chairman, I believe Senator Keith Burns raised the question whether or not he had a bill in similar to this, and that was Senate Bill 141. Senate Bill 141 repeals ORS 12-135, which is different from the Senate Bill 137 here. I might point out that in lines 14 and 15 of Senate Bill 137, this new language anticipates the change that is proposed by Senate Bill 134. Like to pass out copies of the existing law so that I can refer to them in trying to explain what I think is the effect of the Senate Bill 30.
You haven't had a chance to go over this with Steve. Would you come up and join us? You have in your packet an amended 30.
In the amended 30 to the packet that you have there, the amendments which have been adopted by the committee so far are incorporated in the bill.
And briefly, in the first instance, it's filled in by the Army engineers and the submersible land is adjacent to a private owner. He pays the value of the back, and the same is true on the state. If it's filled in by the Corps of Army Engineers, and the only problem we're faced with is if the port fills it in, it's at its own expense.
Yes, Madam Chairman. It's my opinion that the bill as is would require the port or a public body to pay the same as a private individual, say if the fill is not created by the Corps of Engineers. And I would go to page 3 of the bill, section 3.
And that is the value of the submerged and submersible land when it was submerged.
No, Madam.
No.
Under Section 3, this is a general provision. which says that the division may sell, lease, or trade submersible or submerged lands, so on. And on line 6, it says, in the same manner as provided for submersible lands in ORS Chapter 273 and this chapter. If you would, please look at ORS 273-275. That's on the fourth page in on the log that I've passed out. I think this states the price of at which the sale of any state land are to be sold. This exception, which is listed in the first sentence, is 274040, applies to submersible lands. So, in other words, when submersible lands are sold, the price is going to be determined by ORS 274040. Now, that's on the sixth page in, or the second one from the last. And as you can see, that provides that the price will be determined by at a public auction. Yes, I'm bringing it up to simply try to show what the effect of the bill as is will be. And this is in situations where perhaps a public body might want to fill the submerged or submersible lands itself. As I understand the existing statute, a public body is going to have to first get a permit, and secondly, they're going to have to move under this 274915 to have the director sell them this land. Now, the price of the land is going to be determined by this, as I understand it, 274040, which is a public auction. Now, that's that price applies to not only a public body, but also to a private individual, assuming that the state decides to sell the land to them.
Well, the only observation is that I think your assumption on the effect of this bill is right. One of the things we did, and I'm trying to remember what was in 274-930, but I think that was just private individuals, not public body.
All right.
Public riparian owner. If you look here in section 4, 274-925, on page 3 of the bill, it says, whenever the United States, while engaged in the promotion of navigation, creates new lands upon blah, blah, blah. As that used to read, before we stuck in, whenever the United States, in other words, the Corps of Engineers, as it used to read, it would have included ports creating their own lands. And it was the intention of the committee, as I understood it, the advisory committee, to exclude ports from that particular provision. They would, in effect, have to pay for their land according to the provisions of this section. You see, before, there was no payment for the lands created by a port. They became the owner of those lands, and they were able to pay something when they got revenue.
Tony, you want to come up here and chat?
Well, then I would like for you or someone to tell us what we have done in this bill, differentiate between the cost of sales land to individuals, the ports, and the core. Those are the three.
For the the Corps has created land.
We have different payment schedules now.
Right. The Corps has created one,
as you point out, that's why you came from. Now we're going to differentiate it. The amount of money that they're going to pay.
Differentiation between three different situations. The port, or not the port, but the Corps of Engineers filling in front of non-public riparian owners' property,
right.
Corps of Engineers filling in front of public riparian owners' property,
okay.
And a port creating its own fill.
Yeah.
Now, as John suggests, the port would probably fall under the general provision existing, 274.915.
To the highest bidder,
in effect. If it's submersible land, then we probably go back to 274.040, which is highest bidder, not less than $5 an acre.
Under the new bill,
I think that would happen. That has to be the residual effect.
Right.
I don't. Have you got an extra copy of your amended bill?
No, I don't. My question is,
Madam Chairman, I think, first of all, say we have to distinguish how the new land is created, whether by the U.S. or otherwise. If it's not the U.S., under this bill, in my opinion, a port is first going to have to get a permit, and secondly, before they even create the new land, they're going to have to buy the submerged or submersible lands from the state at a price arrived at public auction, which is the same treatment that is given to a private individual if he wants to buy, say, submerged or submersible land in a situation other than where the U.S. creates new land in front of its property.
There is one further problem here, and that is that in the port laws, which were not changed in this bill, the ports generally, in their own law, both the Port of Portland and ports generally, have the authority to manage state lands within their jurisdiction, respectively. Now, part of the argument in their, I think you recall the fact situation, Senator, on which this whole thing was based, the fact that a port would fill land, hold it for speculation, sell it for revenue, and then pay the state a small part of the whole business. All right. The ports generally have authority, at least it says that, in their port law, to manage the land, the state lands within their jurisdiction, however they please. What we're trying to do here is limit that management and say that, all right, if you fill, and the testimony in the committee was that they generally don't fill themselves, they generally fill through the Corps of Engineers contracting for the work, so that when they create it in that manner, they do not become the public owner per se. They pay for it, like the private guys.
Taking care of that one.
Right.
The one
where they don't.
Yeah.
Okay, I think John's right. I think you go back into the general procedure. The only thing I'm pointing out here is there's a little gray area, because if we have only covered what we assume to be the majority of the cases, if not all of them, contracting with the Corps of Engineers to make these bills, then we have to look back and see, well, I wonder if it's necessary to amend the 778 and 777 provisions that give them all the power to exercise whatever power or whatever authority the state could exercise with respect to its land within their jurisdiction.
Right. Now, we're dealing with the public body who is filling the land themselves, aiding it a permit, and then they buy the submersible at public auction at not less than $5 an acre. Can a private person do that?
You mean, could a private person bid in against them? Or could a private person do it, period? No. All right, let me back up. If the private person got a fill permit, so he had the authority to fill, and he was given the authorization to make a certain fill, And as I understand it, the state would in effect have to sell that to him, or the state would have a claim to the fill. So we would then jump back to the old question of how does the state sell submersible and submerged land generally. All right. So we go back to the general provisions, we go back to 274.040 for submersible lands, if that applies, or the general provisions on all state land sales. And we pick it up from there.
Do you agree or don't you agree that the auction in this case is kind of a sham? Should at least there be an appraised price put on the land? I mean,
well, there's only one bidder.
There can be more than one bidder. That's the court. So what's the purpose of an auction in determining the value?
I agree with you. The auction becomes meaningless unless someone is willing to bid in against them.
It would seem like you'd run into a situation more often than not that nobody else is interested in that. It really has no value. The court has a very special reason for wanting it, and it really is not something that would be profitable for anybody else to do, but because they're all around there, they can add on something, and so it's valuable for them to do.
Well, I agree with you, but we're discussing the question of the auction principle here, and I'm only trying to get another way to value the land, maybe at a price.
That auction business runs through our statutes quite a bit, and in many other areas. It's a very old thing, and that's why it's there. You take it as state.
Well, we don't have to preserve it.
I know that, but it's like in the states and everything, they have a provision there. If anybody buys land in the state, everybody, and if somebody else wants to come in, they have to have an auction for the land in the state. Kind of a...
Tony, did you address yourself to the single question of a court obtaining a permit and filling submerged land at its own expense with its own price of that?
Well, Madam Chairman, the last time that this question was discussed by this committee, the committee, and I think wisely so, suggested that the price paid be the value of the submerged land. I thought that was a fair approach to it in this instance, rather than just the auction price. It's obvious that the price of the land is going to be $5 per acre, a minimum fee set with no bidders. And
I think the state under that situation would have a little argument in an auction if there were only one bidder and the minimum price is $5. I agree.
This amendment, of course, Senator Brown, is new to me, the discussion of it.
No, this is not an amendment.
What?
This is
we're talking about a gray area.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Well, then the amendment that you discussed.
We're not
asking
any amendments.
Prior.
One theory. Well, do we want to leave it at that? The public body who has obtained the permit and filled with their own facilities pays at the $5 value.
Then, Senator Brown, I would have to say that the advisory committee suggested that be changed, and I would concur with that same suggestion. And with the method that appeared to me to be the most logical is the one that came up in discussion here in this committee, that the port be required to pay the price of the submerged land based on a valuation by the state Division of State Lands.
I'd like to ask Senator Meeker, why couldn't it be that treat the port the same as when the United States does the fill, and that they become can buy the land less any cost that they had in doing the filling themselves? Wouldn't this to give them credit for their cost involved, but treat them under the same provision?
Well, Senator Iverson, I'd like to give that some thought, because if I recall, there are sometimes that there's a good deal of cost involved, and they would, if that were the case, we might be better off with a $5 situation.
Well, I mean, you could put the minimum that they could do that, but not less than the $5 or something like that.
Oh, but could
you
even make it
10? Or whatever it is, but to give them credit for any cost as long as it didn't bring...
If the minimum was high enough, Madam Chairman, I...
Senator Kiefer.
How often does a parcel of land fall in this category?
Where the port does it itself? I'd have to defer answering the question to the port.
I think Kiefer's going to happen more and more often.
Anybody from the ports here?
Madam Chairman, if I may react to this entire question, and it relates to a discussion that evolved in the advisor committee. When public lands are filled that were prior submerged or submersible lands, two things happen. The first thing happens is that the upland owner, whether it be the port or private owner, then becomes has new land. And he should pay for that. The second thing that happens is that the navigable waters, which belong to the people of Oregon, are forever abated, and that those navigable waters would not be returned unless the fill were removed. So regardless of who the upland owner is, whether it be a port or a private individual, the city of Portland or who, it appears to me that the public should gain by the removal of this public right or the use of navigable waters. And if this philosophy, I think, can be found in the suggestion that the advisory committee made here, that the monies belong to the Common School Fund for payment of the extinguishment of a public right.
Well,
Senator
John,
I was
going to
make a motion.
Well, as I understand, we've got three propositions. Where a public body has gotten its permit and fills at its own expense. We have leave the law as it is and it goes for $5 an acre. We have the proposition before us to appraise the submerged land and establish a value of it as submerged land and the possibility of putting a minimum floor. And the third, Senator Ivers, is to appraise it as
like this provision that we adopted, but to give the port credit for any costs that they had in filming it.
Would you make a minimum charge?
I think I'd have a minimum, yeah.
A minimum that the cost of their filling wouldn't apply against?
That's right. So that the state would still get at least for the submerged land prior to the fill.
I'm sure. George, I think...
It just kind of depends which port.
Who's going to determine the value of the fill? I mean, that's going to be
their cost of filling it, I think.
Right, the cost of...
Who's going to determine that? What would be easier if they get the appraisal of the value of the land in its submerged state before they fill? That's the easy way to do it, appraise the land. And that gives the public their benefit of selling the land.
I don't think that gives the public their value because there's a potential there.
Well, of course, what you're saying is that force the public body.
Well, some of us look upon it as sort of an autonomous government.
Well, after Washington, Clinton, and the county goes there, you'll go along with it.
No, I'm going to move to a Harney County.
Senator Donberg.
I was going to move.
Be appraised at its value and submerged.
Do
you want to put a minimum on
that? He wants to get
it
appraised first.
Madam Chairman?
I just want to get it moving. If you want to, the committee feels that now there might not even be one going on the committee for that
proposal.
Yeah. Maybe I withdraw the motion and discuss it. I can't speak to a minimum, Madam Chairman. I I'd be amenable to a little help.
Mr. Cox, do you want to make any observations add to a minimum.
No, Madam Chairman, I just assume have the appraisal, what Senator Smith indicated, the appraisal of the value of the submersible or submersible land, and leave it at that, and try to speak to a minimum.
I think we've got two factors here that the advisory committee recognized, and I think you've recognized in your proceedings here. You've got the payment of the cost of transfer of title and so forth, but the state, Division of State Lands will be doing and will come out of the Common School Fund at any rate. So they've got to at least cover the business expense of transferring title to the land. Now that's minimal. So that should be, if there is a minimum, maybe that should be the minimum, or that should be treated separately with no minimum on the appraised value. Well, so at least the Common School Fund doesn't lose that administrative expense.
The point is, in the appraisal of the land, the state land board is going to have a hand in it.
Right.
Well, don't you think that they're going to know that the cost of their administrative cost and holding the land is a part of the cost of selling it, and therefore they're not going to allow it.
The only reason I suggest that, Senator, is because we had, and I don't know what it's like now in your bill, we had differentiated between the administrative cost of transferring title and the cost of the land itself, whatever that's going to be. We picked that up from existing law on the non-public riparian owner. He had to pay the administrative fees of transferring title.
That has nothing to do with this question.
Well, you asked what should be the minimum amount paid.
I'm suggesting there shouldn't be any minimum.
Oh, okay.
Because the state land board is going to be people that are appraising the land, and they're going to sell the land for
enough to recover their cost.
Well, that requires a further amendment. There is a minimum in the statute now, $5. Your motion is that you appraise value and just leave the $5 alone.
We could continue the advisory committee indefinitely. And maybe Cecil would outlive us.
Well, I'd like a point of clarification. Maybe Steve or Tony could answer this. When the port does this, this could conceivably be on submersible land in front of a private owner. Now, is this right? The upland owner would be private, and they could still fill in front of him and eliminate his waterfront rights?
Well, that I suppose is possible. The Corps could fill in front.
Yes.
The port could probably fill in front for a supreme navigational reason. The way this is, and I don't want to say always been handled, but testimony before the committee was that this is usually handled by the port coming in and buying up that fellow's frontage rights, his riparian rights, filling, and then they have filled in front of public riparian land.
Well,
so that they then would, under the old statute, immediately become the owner.
Well, I realize they could, if they went in and bought it, certainly,
no.
But I want to be sure that they can't do it in
no.
front of a private owner and
no.
wipe him out.
No, because 274-940, which is the last, it's section 6 in the printed bill on page 4.
The new bill?
Well, I don't know about the new bill. Anyway, it's 274-940, which currently guarantees a right of access for a riparian owner across lands owned or filled, lands created by these fills. Access across such
that.
Reserved new lands to navigable water.
Well, access, of course, this could mean a narrow strip being able to get down
that's
there.
That's right.
But before that happened, he had maybe 1,000 feet of river frontage. He's going to be wiped out.
Well,
I don't know. I'm asking you, is it possible?
I suppose it's possible because
Diesel
the Corps has
yes.
navigational servitude just like the, or I mean the port does, just like the Corps of Engineers does. That's part of their statutory power that they have to carry out. But I'm saying normally, from what the testimony before the advisory committee was, that they never do it this way. They always buy up the property because it's usually for a car parking lot or some other port-associated activity. So they want the backland, the upland, so that they can get this ownership through this statute.
I was thinking, of course, places where there's several acres of submersible land, like there in Portland near Swan Island or someplace where they've dumped millions of cubic feet of sand to build it up. And if they did, well, that's sorry. Go ahead. He may clear it up.
Senator Ivers, on page 4 of the printed bill in section 5, the advisory committee changed the language so that the only person who could do this without permission from the division would be the United States, keeping in mind that the port could circumvent that by having the United States do the fill for them.
Oh, well, that doesn't answer the question, because the submersible lands are owned by the state.
But the upland owner is what I'm talking about. No one other than the United States, while engaging, shall artificially create new...
Without the approval of the landowner. Well, that says the approval of the owner of the submersible land.
All right.
In
Portland, for instance, on the Willamette River, the submersible lands in most cases are owned by the upland owner, unless they've been conveyed away somehow.
Would it do violence to the proposal here if on page 4, line 7, after the word D, second D, amended to say, without the approval of the insert upland land, and then put a period after the word owner, so that it would read, without the approval of the upland land owner. Would it do violence to it? Yeah. It would.
Well, I think it would.
What law school did you go to, Charlie?
The same one you did.
All right. Tell me why.
Well, because then he wouldn't have to get permission from the Division of State Land.
Yeah. See, they own the land. I just want information about taking those Portland
and the
upland.
Beyond
that point, the port can condemn the land along there anyway. So you're not going to protect the landowner anymore in this bill than he's already protected in the union.
Well, I don't want to prolong this, but they wouldn't have to take the private owner's land. They've got 50 acres of submersible land that's owned by the state, and they get permission to fill it. That's maybe all they would need. And they wouldn't need the upland owner's land.
You would undermine them.
Well, yeah, but except you'd wipe out the soil.
Well, if you added
a can add a hand.
Yeah.
Pay the price of the submerged land as it was in its submerged state after an appraisal. Right? For the discussion on this motion, clerk call the roll.
Dan Burns.
Aye.
Keith Burns.
No.
Ivers.
No.
Hoy.
Aye.
Aye. without the approval of the owner of such land and the upland land owner.
I'll so move. I'm not. I wonder, Madam Chairman, could I ask Cecil a question?
Surely.
Cecil, do you think that this would, that I have undue fears for the upland owner here, or do you think this would take care of it?
Well, I'd make kind of a black answer. In Goose Bay, for example, Weyerhaeuser owns a great deal of submersible lands and don't own the upland. Now, what happens if they fail? Or what happens if the core fills on that land and shuts off the upland?
That's what I was thinking about, where all this upland owner is just completely wiped out, other than the constitutional right to access, which could be a narrow strip.
Well, Madam Chairman,
Senator
Downright, the upland landowner under the amendment suggested would have to give permission in order for the warehouse to be.
Well, under the proposed amendment, yeah.
Yes.
This,
okay.
But I mean the way it is now.
Mr. DeWinter, do you think the proposed amendment accomplishes what Senator Ivan wants to accomplish?
Madam Chairman, just offhand, yes.
Senator Meeker, any comments?
Yeah. I think it does. The job that he wants.
Further discussion.
He wanted to, he had, was trying to get something in.
This is out of my competence, really, but I think there's a law case that holds that the owner of the submersible land is the upland owner.
And tide land.
Submersible tide land, he becomes the upland owner.
In tide land.
Yeah.
Not in freshwater land. You're right, for tide land.
But not in freshwater.
Not
well, I know in tide
river
land there's that thing, because it's developed down in Newport.
All right, is there further discussion of the amendment proposed by Senator Ivers on page 4? Clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
Ivers.
Aye.
Hoy.
Aye.
Smith.
Aye.
Madam
Chairman.
Aye.
I need to do it.
Madam Chairman, could I interject? there's another possibility here that is not covered by the law, and that is, say, where you've got a private individual. What value is he going to pay, say, if he gets a permit from the state approves it, he makes the fill, what value is he going to pay? Under the bill and the existing law, he will pay at the auction, the value at the auction, minimum of $5. I just raise this as another question, a policy question. What does the committee want to do in that situation?
Treat it the same.
We're back to the situation where the port fills itself.
No.
Private. Can you do that?
Who gets a permit to fill from the department? Puts his own fill in at his own cost.
All right. If he gets the approval of the state of Oregon through the Division of State Lands to make the fill, he's getting the approval of the division working under the Water Resources Board. So it has nothing to do with the approval of the owner of the land.
Come again?
No, we want to know what, how much he should pay.
All right. Okay. I'm just trying to get to it. All right, John is probably right. He's going to have to pay the auction, the bid value, not less than $5 for the private owner. The statute only covers the case where the United States Corps of Engineers fills in front of private repairing up.
You're talking about where a private
owner gets a permit and fills in front of his own land. Now, what bothers me is administratively in here, when the decision is made by the Division of State Lands acting under its fill permit authority to grant the fill permit, it knows that that private owner is going to cover the existing state land. Now, my question is, and I think we had testimony on it, what does the division do? Do they try and make a forced sale of the land, knowing that it's going to be covered? What? Do I make sense what I'm trying to say? You've under a permit authority, you've given them the right to fill. Now, at that time, it seems like the state has to say, all right, that's no longer submerged or
let's stay away from submerged. That's no longer submersible land. Now, at that time, does the division force a sale acting under its land ownership authority? Because they know it's going to be filled.
Yeah, I think we would follow the present statute and have it, after it's filled, appraise it and sell it at appraised price.
But the present statute doesn't cover the private owner doing it in front of his own land.
Yes, it does.
Privately. Or it's...
Yes, it does. You have amended that portion of the...
What part of the statute is that?
Well, the old 930, I think. It's repealed, I know. We rewrote it.
Well... Why don't we just take Senator Smith's motion to have it at the appraised value of the submerged land as it was in the submerged state? Discussion of Senator, this is applicable to a private
right.
owner who has gotten a permit from the department and filled
that's
at
right.
his own expense.
We filed it up. We didn't file it up.
Discussion of Senator Smith's motion.
Well, the old question comes up here. It's conceivable to me that you can fill the land at a very low cost and have some very valuable property, and I don't think the private owner should have a windfall.
Well, just the opposite, Madam Chairman. The cost of filling this land is extreme. And
more than it's worth.
Oh, yeah. It does add its value to the other land.
Okay.
It's very expensive, and I don't know what that is.
I don't know what situation would arise. I suppose it would be somewhere private in the well.
Madam Chairman, if I could approach this once more, maybe we can get it solved. All right, under old 274-930.
Well, where do you find it?
It's an existing statute. This would repeal it. We drafted Section 2 of the Act to replace it. Under old Section 930, it said whenever a fill is created on lands in front of private upland riparian land, then it set forth the procedure for sale to the private upland owner. So when anybody did it, including the owner himself. All right, then you look back at Section 5 on page 4 of the bill, and you see this old 274-920, and it said even then, even in the old law, if you restore what's in the brackets, it said no one other than the United States or a public body, while engaged in the promotion of navigation, industry, or commerce, shall artificially create new lands without the approval of the owner of such land. So in essence, what that said was that no private owner can do it, even under a fill permit. If you see the distinction, a fill permit is only to protect the waterways. It has nothing to do with ownership. I hope I'm saying this right. It's a completely different function. It has nothing to do with the land ownership jurisdiction of the land board and division. So if the private owner fills without the approval of the state of Oregon, even with a fill permit, he's trespassing. If he gets the fill permit, that's probably evidence of their approval, since they knew about it and didn't act. If he doesn't even get a fill permit, he's certainly trespassing. But this statute, even now, as we've amended it, would require him to get the approval of the owner of such land, which in this case is the state of Oregon. So maybe there's no problem. Maybe it's...
But what should he pay for the land?
Okay.
So before us, how much should he pay for the land anyway? After he gets the fill permit.
Okay. All right. Okay. Then I'd suggest that if that's your problem and you want to get away from the $5 highest bid, that maybe we should just go back to this, something similar to old 274-930.
We're suggesting we go back to the appraisal. Bid.
Okay, fine.
Just as we did with the other situation.
Right. That's the motion before.
Will the money hear that motion?
No. If you'd like to amend the amendment for the minimum, the chairman will be glad to entertain.
There's no minimum because we went over that in the other
recommendation.
This is the same situation. The state land board still controls the appraisal. They know what the land's going to cost them to transact. In the appraisal of that land, they can. There's no reason for a minimum, right? unless there's no reason for him.
Does the landlord agree with that logic?
As a practical matter, Senator, we've never used the minimum. We've appraised the land, and the minimum on the public bid has been the appraisal price, the appraise of the land
at auction. Now you'll be able to set the value of your land on appraisal if this amendment passes.
Without auction.
And
what do you wish to amend the amendment?
Well, no, if the landlord says that this is not necessary, that you're doing it already and it's not necessary, I don't think we're amending it.
Further discussion on the amendment.
Court
call
and
the motion is that a private owner who wishes to fill merchant land has to first obtain a permit from the department. Having obtained the permit from the department, the motion concerns the price that he shall pay for the merchant land upon which he's going to build. And the motion is that it shall be an appraisal price of the value of the merchant land as it was in its submerged state.
Don't you think they should take into consideration the value after the appeal?
Part of the appraisal?
Is that in here? No, it isn't.
Right.
The question has been raised, should a part of the appraisal be consider the value of the land after the
Remember, we got the situation, Bob, where they're going to fill for nothing.
No, this isn't. Our Army engineer is out of this entirely.
No, this is only the guy that does it himself.
Supposing the guy knows that there's going to be some dredging going off there, they're going to have to dump it someplace, and he's counting on the Corps of Engineers to dump it there.
Well, then it comes under another.
It's not
the
Corps.
It's
not
under another.
If it's a Corps, he pays the full value.
And then he pays for the cost.
Otherwise, of course, section we would take.
Madam Chairman, I think what Senator Sue Burns has said, and this has been going through our entire deliberations, even back to the interim committee, that you can, many circumstances, situations, get land filled, even if you go out and do it at a fairly cheap price in relation to what that value is going to be after it's filled. And there could be a great disparity between the cost of the value of that land prior to fill and after it's filled. And I think this is a basic question.
There's also a question of equity. If you're going to charge, if the guy wants to fill in front of his own land, he goes to the expense of doing it, then you're going to charge him for the fill that it's costing to put in because it has raised the value of state land plus the state land. Now you've charged him twice for the same
No,
I mean, I'm not saying that'll fix the price. All I'm saying is they should take that into consideration. I can see a third party coming in there, if not the owner of the upland party that's buying the submerged land. I see a speculator coming in there to deal. I just like to involve landlord taking into consideration the value of the land after it's filled.
Do you wish to move to amend the amendment say that the appraisal shall include consideration of the value of the land after it's filled? I so moved that there's an amendment to the proposed amendment that the appraisal include consideration of the value of the land after it is in a filled state. Discussion of the amendment to the amendment. Senator Meeker.
Madam Chairman, I think perhaps you in presenting some of the information we just have to you might have misled, and perhaps we should cover this alternative. If you've taken care of the Corps of Engineer problem in the bill, you've taken care of the port problem in the bill, Now, the other problem that was raised relates to a private owner filling land in front of his upland.
Yes,
yeah,
that's what happened.
Is this limited to the owner of the upland?
Yes.
That's all we're talking about.
But let's look at it in this light. That on page 3 of the bill, in section 3, the division on line 4, the division currently has the power to sell, lease, or trade submerged or submersible land. Now, in this instance, the owner of the submerged or submersible land is the state of Oregon, and they could require a lease of that sale under the Attorney General's 92-page opinion. And in the stipulations of the lease, would never give up the sale of that, or give up title to that land, but would require a lease from the private owner.
They could.
And I think that causes then no need for the amendment that you discussed.
Where is this land, Tony?
Maybe we
should
have it.
This is in the condition of the sale.
We're just trying to point out that they don't sell every time. They don't have to sell every time.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. The question has been moved. All in favor of putting the question, which is Senator Burns' amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Senator Burns' amendment is to include in the appraisal the consideration of the value of the property as it is when it is built. First call of roll.
Aye.
Aye. Now the main motion is back to selling the submerged land at its value in its submerged state with the amendment we just added, the appraisal to include the value as it is when it's filled. Questions in the call for all in favor of putting the question, say aye.
Aye.
Clerk, call roll.
Dan Burns.
Aye.
Keith Burns.
Aye.
Ivor.
Aye.
Hoyt.
Aye.
Smith.
No.
Madam Chairman.
Aye. Senator John Burns moves bill out to pass.
Madam Chairman.
Senator,
what? Well, I assume we've got all the other bonds taken care of. I would prefer, rather than move this bill out today, that we have it in vote and we have it before us for final passage. For the reason that there has a lot of people involved in the work that, in the
right,
report.
The motion to withdraw. Right. The next bill, Mr. DeWitter, is what?
We could move to Senate Bill 38, Madam Chairman. I think that's a simple bill. Madam Chairman, this, as the members of the committee may know, was the bill that Representative Magruder testified on. There's only one amendment to the bill, and that amendment was suggested by Mr. Redden. Again, I think his testimony was that he did not support the bill, but if the bill did pass out of the committee, he would prefer to have this amendment inserted. And this means that a person could not use any material that's deposited on submerged or submersible lands in front of his property as an article of commerce unless or until after eight or more years have passed.
And has that amendment been moved, or was it just asked to be drafted?
Madam Chairman, that was an amendment which Mr. Redden submitted to the committee, and it has not been adopted yet.
Okay. Discussion?
Now, this has nothing to do with the use of that material for foundation or something on that land or for reclaiming that. We're only talking about the sale of an article of commerce.
Seller.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Senator Keefran moves Mr. Redden's amendment. Further discussion on the amendment.
What's the amendment here?
Let's put this for 8 years.
Yes.
Yeah,
yeah,
I think that's.
8 years.
Okay.
I'm not leaving.
Further discussion. Clerk, call the roll on.
No.
Wait a minute, what is it on the bill? Pass the floor? No.
Ivers?
not sure. No. Think about this. I mean, I'm not basically opposed to the bill. I'm more opposed to the eight-year thing, and I think this ties it up too long.
Okay.
Something reasonable, three or something. But 8 years is, wow, I don't know how you went for that, Bob, tying it up for 8 years. That's unreasonable.
Madam Chairman, at the committee's pleasure, if you want to move to 39, we could. Otherwise, I would say that Senate Bill 139 and perhaps Senate Bill 139 is more simple, I think, than Senate Bill 39.
All right, let's take a quick look at 139 and see if we can reach an agreement on it. This is a bill that would release the requirement for verification of the pleading where the party has to sign the pleading itself. It's a bar bill where the party would no longer have to sign the pleading. Senator Carson testified before us in opposition to the bill. He felt that he would just as soon do away with the requirement that pleadings be notarized, but that he felt at least there should be a certification by the party of the pleading. The alternatives, I guess, are to pass it as is, to amend it in Senator Carson's fashion.
This is the one that on the signing of the pleading. What my pleasure? Well, I'm in favor of the bill. What should I do? Oh, I tell you, there was a suggested amendment that I think kind of I thought would make everybody happy.
Carson suggested that there be at least a certification and possibly eliminate
a
notary.
I had a better amendment. My amendment was that you just have the attorney sign it, and when it's served, if they want to have it verified by the party, for the attorney who signed it, they could request it within 10 days and make such a request and be required to do so. And I think you're thinking about care about 98% of the institution.
Senator Carson raised the possibility of there being material in there that might be liable with something else, and then you get the party on the stand and
my amendment to take care of that. The person gets it and they say, okay, that's fine. If they want to verify that, fine, then do it. The great bulk of litigation, nobody ever requests to be verified. In most rare instances, well, they can request to be done as a requirement. And the only reason I make this confession is because the point that's raised that in the federal courts you have notice pleading, where you just give notice you got a cause of action, and then read the pleading in the pretrial order after you get a long way down the track. And the complaint to the state court is considerably different than that. But I think this would take care of that situation. I would move such amendment conceptually, and then we'd ask John DeWinter to prepare the amendment.
Excuse me, Madam Chairman. I think there should be that amendment prepared in the packet that you have there. Should have the heading amendment prepared or proposed by Senator Keith Byrne.
I took my
Madam Chairman, the only change that I've made in there is in the second subsection. I've simply said that where a party receives a pleading which has been duly subscribed and requests that the pleading be verified, then that it must be verified. And I've inserted the existing statutory language relating to verification then in the subsection.
I may ask a question, Madam Chairman. Duly subscribed, that means signed by the attorney?
That would be signed as stated in section 1 of, or subsection 1
of the bill.
Of the bill, yes.
I don't see what difference between what you've written here and what we have in the bill, because it says down the middle, the affidavit may be made by the agent or attorney.
By the party or resident attorney. You're talking about up in subsection 1?
Well,
you're looking at the amendment.
Okay.
Where is that, Scott?
Well, that's
for a corporation. That's just in case the corporation says something. You gotta have
John, we're discussing 139.
Well, it says when a corporation is a party, the verification may be made by any officer thereof. Is that what you mean, that sentence?
No. It's
about the middle.
Oh, well, that's existing law, isn't it?
Yes, excuse me.
No, the thing is where, where you've got, if everything's within the knowledge of the attorney, he can do it anyway.
Yeah.
If he says it's within his knowledge, all the facts are. Where it's just a note that hadn't been paid or something like that, why an attorney can do it now. I say all the facts within my knowledge, and he can verify it now. I think in that sense it's no change, isn't it, John?
What I have done here is simply taken the bar bill as proposed, and I've left in subsection 1, which would require only subscription. Then, in addition to that, I put in a subsection 2, which would provide that after a party receives the pleading, which has been duly subscribed, that is according to subsection 1, if that party requests a verification, then such verification would have to be given. Now, the language here in the language in subsection 2 of the amendment is taken directly out of the existing law with regard to verification.
Is your proposed amendment?
Yes.
Can I
You know, I practice under the 70 rules too, and it's pretty nice where you don't have to sign the where you sign the pleadings yourself. And I think the arguments made by the people from the bar with the people are, I think the signing has some value. Argue it to the jury, but maybe we're getting away from this business of arguing these things to the jury and trying to have the tribunal be more of a trier of fact than a forum for legal forensics. My point is, wouldn't it be cleaner to do it one way or the other if we're going to go the federal way, go the whole route rather than file it up?
I'm happy to support the bar bill. I'm perfectly happy with it. I thought that there, that this was a middle ground that might be more acceptable to members of the committee. Here's the problem with me. This is a little bit longer. If this is moved to the floor do pass as it is, and it's defeated, I don't know what we do at that point.
How about one of you making a motion? Do you move to pass the amendment or the bill?
Oh, I
know. You move the bill.
Fine.
Senator John Burns moves the bill to the floor with a do pass recommendation discussion.
I don't want to carry it. I'll carry it.
If I have one.
We're not there yet.
Oh, all right.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Ivers.
I think I'm more impressed with the argument of Senator Carson, and I wish he were here to testify. It just eliminates the notary part of it and still let the party sign it. I think there's some value in having him sign it rather than his attorney and then later on saying that, I never told my attorney that or something else. So I would oppose Senator Burns.
Senator John Burns withdraws his motion. Senator Keith Burns moves that Senate Bill 139 be amended as the amendment is drawn by Mr. Clement. Discussion.
Senator Carson was in it, because as I read it, and you say it in a certain language, the lawyer, so his adversary lawyer says, did you really say this?
Right.
You didn't mean it.
I'm talking to John DeWitt.
And so then all the lawyer has to do is sign, yes, I mean it. Doesn't say yes when I read it.
That's right. It just doesn't do what Carson wants. No, it doesn't.
Even on the second
that's right.
Do you want to withdraw your amendment?
So I've got an amendment to the amendment.
Okay.
You're right.
What's the time for it? 10 days?
There you go.
Specific language.
Well, if you don't have it ready, I think.
Well, just that. Well, what I'm trying to do here is to put a time limitation when they can request the verification at any time prior to the time that's necessary for them to respond by statute.
All right. Senator Keith Burns' amendment to the amendment is that the request for a verification has to be made prior to the time that is required for an answer by statute.
Well, it can't be just an answer because it's talking about two.
Yeah, right.
Well, this doesn't help you at all.
Am I mistaken about reading what it says here?
Okay.
What's your...
My point is that after you make the request for verification, you still don't know what if the guy read it.
Exactly what you have now. You don't know that you read it, but you've got a verification the facts are true. And remember the discussion we had that they say even now sometimes the person said he didn't read it, that makes you embarrassed as the attorney a little bit. At
well,
he ought to be embarrassed.
Pardon me?
He ought to be embarrassed.
Well, I know that, but this is, I think we've had
right.
that discussion.
We have an amendment to the amendment. Is there a discussion on the proposed amendment? Clerk call roll on the board of amendments. To the amendment. Dan Burns?
No.
Keith Burns?
Aye.
Ivers?
No.
Boyd?
No.
Smith?
No.
Carroll?
No.
The amendment is now before us. Is there a discussion on the amendment? Clerk call roll on the amendment.
Aye.
Ivers?
No.
Hoyt?
No.
Smith?
No.
Madam Chairman? No. Senator John Burns moves to table House Bill 139. Discussion. Clerk call roll. John Burns?
Aye.
Keith Burns?
No.
Ivers?
Aye.
Hoyt?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
We're on 36 now.
Bill 36. We followed closely the study of the advisory committees of the state land board, and we feel that we want to support Senate Bill 36 in its entirety. We feel that the people and that the state, it is time that they have a directive and policy to work from in establishing ownership or disclaiming ownership of land in the Willamette River system, the navigable stream. This is one that has been a tremendous amount of time and effort put forth by many people, and I think we've come to the point where it's necessary to proceed. And we certainly like for you people to consider this matter in taking positive action in accepting Senate Bill 36. I have a map here that was given me by member of the State Land Board, Mr. Stanley Hamilton, their engineer, and it's a map from some of the upper reaches of the Willamette River system above Corvallis, known as Kiger Island. And I'd like to hold this up and show you some of the channels that the river has crossed back and forth over the last 200 years or more. And it seems that in doing this, that you can see the complex problem that we are faced with here, disclaiming ownership and claiming ownership. And it seems to me that if I might, at this point, Madam Chairman, say that it's all important. My comments are that it's all important that the state only claim the present bed of the present stream, because otherwise you will have a tremendous, tremendous task on your hands trying to claim ownership of the old bed of the stream, which has moved back and forth through this entire area and covers private deeded lands as such. And the difficulty in trying to, the stream's moving this way towards Portland, and these are the many meandering channels that has been used in the past. This is Kiger Island. So it is going to be very difficult, very, very difficult to take any other approach, as I see it personally, to claim anything other than the present bed of the Willamette River because of this reason. I want to say this to you, Madam Chairman, and members of this committee, that the people of this state are very tax conscious in how the money is being spent. And we have a case at Corvallis that's been in process over 20 years trying to disclaim or claim ownership of the stream. And I certainly wouldn't want to see this continue on, because the people of this state are very conscious of how the money is being spent. And we're not asking that the state pass by anything that doesn't belong to them, but by the same token, there can be a tremendous amount of litigation in this area as it relates to the ownership of these lands. I, with this, I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to appear here today.
I appreciate it.
Mr. Hathaway was here at the last meeting on this particular matter, and he suggested that the real way to do this would be to follow the river stream.
That's what I'm...
Now, does the bill itself provide for that guideline, or is it just a study?
I'd like to refer that... I just got a copy of this bill today, at late date, and I'd like to refer that question to Mr. William S. Cox. I think those people are very able to answer it out of me.
Mr. Cox, will you come up here, please? Would you repeat your question?
Well, I must confess that I haven't read every word of this bill, and I'm really impressed with the testimony Mr. Hathaway gave and Mr. Hamilton supporting. Does the bill give any direction to the study as to how it should go in terms of what happens to the stream, ownership as the stream changes its course?
It states that the land board should make the study, and then in the first part of the bill defines certain procedures, which are in the latter, first and latter part, defines certain procedures that the land board must get go through to proclaim or to, after the study has been made, what they must do to make this public aware of the material and information that they...
Mr. Hogg, would you briefly state the common law regarding the ownership of the...
I'm glad you added the latter.
You want just a brief description of you want just a brief description of the effect of... Yeah, thank you.
accretion erosion where the river moves from one channel to the other by normal means where there's no immediate or perceptible voltage change, in other words, no violent change that everybody can see and prove, then the ownership of the bed and the banks and so forth moves with the erosion or the reliction or the accretion, whichever of those applies. Accretion being an addition, reliction being the drying up or the receding of the water, leaving land now upland that was formerly non-upland. Erosion being just the washing away of a part of the upland into and becoming a part of the submerged or submersible land of the stream. Okay, the problem is that sometimes it's hard to tell the difference between an avulsion, which is the violent change, and the violent change effect is very briefly that where a stream changes channels, let's say, by violent means, that the ownership remains as is. In other words, the ownership doesn't change with the stream. The state would be the owner of the abandoned bed, the dry land. The private owner would be the owner of the new bed, just as he was before, except that now the public would have a navigational easement across his private land because the water is now there. That's the basic effect, maybe.
Are there further questions?
Well, what does this bill do?
Wait, let's get Mr. Endicott first.
Well, I still have to ask my question.
Yeah, but I'll give him up here next. I'd like to hear from Mr. Endicott. Are there further questions for Mr. Endicott? Senator John.
How long have you had your ranch? How long have I had?
Well, how long has the family
had? How long has there been a deed title to the ranch? 1853 and 1863.
You go back as far as Cecil
Edwards. All right, I have another question, Madam Chairman.
Senator John Burke.
You got title insurance on these lands in here?
You do. Wait a minute. Madam Chairman, I'd like to answer his question right.
Surely.
When he says title insurance, yes. There's different. He's referring to my particular instance. There are different. Some of them are school land. Some of them are Hogue donation land claims. See, so it makes different references.
Well,
as to the different descriptions.
Just to clarify, Madam Chair, you've been through it on the advisory committee and others have. Where the river has meandered from one place to another over this period of years, and we're in this never-never land in between, and we speak to quiet title, as it were. The thing that concerns me is that on the passing of title of land to your ranch, that from one owner to the other, the time you acquired X number of acres, part of which included some in between there, assuming they're not school lands or anything like that, but they were represented as being property that was being sold to you. Did a title insurance company issue title insurance pursuant to the sale before the land was acquired?
Yes, in part.
We're told by some authority that they shouldn't have this, but no.
And who is the some authority?
Well, I don't know what that part of the authority.
Well, we relate ourselves as being riparian owners. And we yes.
But some people say, if I understand and follow correctly, that while you represent yourself as the owner, some of that is being there, you're really not, really state land because of the change in flow of the river, right?
No, I can't answer you that as being correct.
Okay.
Senator Smith.
In 1968, as I read this news report, the state land board made a study of 13 miles of the Willamette River, and they said at that time that the state may own thousands of acres of land, and I suppose that initiative is what has caused a great deal of and after that study, they said that they owned the land. Now, what makes you think that a study conducted by the state land board is not going to maintain they own from the Columbia River to the California border?
Madam Chairman.
Oh, Mr.
I'm not a full authority on this particular matter, but I do not think that the people in the state of Oregon or the state land board intend to claim ownership of the present stream bed and the old stream bed only in case of where there's an evolving change. I don't think that the courts in this land, as it relates to common law, that this would be upheld in any way, because how can you claim where it's been when it's crossed over all of this in the last 200 years? My question. How can you claim that? And that's what this river has done. It seems to be only logical and sensible that we use common judgment and relate to where the stream bed is today, and that the state owned that stream bed. And as it meanders, the state still remains the ownership of that stream bed, not where it was 50 years ago, 20 years ago, or 200 years ago. That's my point.
Well, whatever makes you think that government follows good judgment.
Madam Chairman, I would feel that in respect to all of you at this committee, that the citizens of this state respect our government still, and answer your question.
Well, my only concern is, and maybe I should direct Madam Chairman my question to Mr. Collins. You're going to conduct this study, construction of the river, and it's going to be your purpose to try to identify where the river is now, and then grant the land to the landowner. Is that going to be the purpose of this study?
The purpose
of legitimatize the ownership of the land?
The purpose of the study is to make a positive assertion of what the state believes it owns after this comprehensive study of the river and the surrounding land.
All right, Madam Chair, another question.
Yeah. Well, do you have any more, Mr. Endicott?
Is it your feeling that, and your neighbors, that a big percentage of the controversy will be eliminated by this process, and that a very small part will have to go to court?
True.
That's the basis of this
yes.
Of this bill.
Yes, that is true.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Now, let's have the...
Well, Madam Chairman, I want to... I have a question, Mr. Cox.
Yeah, right.
I want to ask you.
Go ahead.
Now, the state at one time claimed that, I suppose the officer, they owned all former riverbeds.
I'm not too sure that they... law of states, I'm not aware of a law of states they own all former navigable riverbeds. I believe the state can lose its title by the gradual drying up of a riverbed just like anybody else.
Well, I'm trying to get to the bottom of the direction, Bill, that you're going to take in this study, and I assume it's going to be that you're going to try to outline at the moment the riverbed in this area. Is that right?
Yes. Senator, we have an example of what we've done here, but essentially we take the all available maps of the river, surveys, and photographs as well that have been in some manner controlled by proper methods of aerial photography. We take the original surveys, we overlay them to trace where the river has gone from 1859, which is the time that the state became the owner, down to the present time, and in doing so and gathering in as much historical data as is possible from newspaper articles, information from the riparian owners along one and other outside information, county courthouses and this, we can trace how the river got from where it was in 1859 to the present time. And we can make, in many cases, not all of them, but in many cases, we can pretty well tell whether the movement of the river was a slow, gradual one or this rapid one, which would cause an avulsion. And this is our process. And at the end of this is I have a land board directive to make a statement as to what the state owns and then publicize this to all the interested landowners involved so that they are completely aware of it.
Then I assume if there are contests, it can be settled in court.
Well, I have some specific testimony in regard to this, as which has come about as a result of some of the information we've retrieved from the landowners, and in speaking directly to some of the provisions in this bill, which we would like to make a suggestion on some changes in the provisions in the present bill.
Well, if he's going to go through the bill, maybe I'll... No, I want to get Senator Meeker's over an hour. Before I have Senator Meeker, I'd like to explain there seems to be some misunderstanding that this was a hearing. It was a work session on all bills except 36. 36 was to be heard. On Senate Bill 39, I asked the land board and Mr. Perrin and Mr. Angstrom to either reconcile their differences on amendments or to provide us with a clear-cut issue. I understand that hasn't been done, and I wish you would continue your work till you're able to give us your information in a clear-cut form soon. Is there anybody from out of town or has missed work that had the misunderstanding that they could be heard on some bill here? All right, Senator Meeker and Mr. Edwards, please.
Madam Chairman, Senate Bill 36 relates to the primary mission that historically created the Advisory Committee to the Land Board, conflict of ownership on the abandoned channels and existing channels of the Willamette River. Now, Senate Bill 36 establishes procedures to settle these conflicts of interest and places a time limitation on a certain portion of the river by 1976, January 1st, and in a completed survey on the remainder of the river by 1978. Now, the Advisory Committee, in recommending Senate Bill 36, in a majority opinion, evolved the bill before you. And there was a minority opinion filed by Senator Brown, who is chairman of the Subcommittee on Navigable Waterways. And the difference between the two is that the majority bill would not only require the Division of State Lands to claim what the state owns, but to disclaim interest in lands that it did not own. And Senator Brown's minority report leaves out the disclaimer procedure. And I think that this should be considered by your committee, the differences between the two, and some kind of decision be made on that issue. Now, the committee was aware of the fact that the land board may inherently already have the power to affect settlement of riverbed land claims and boundary disputes, regardless of the passage of this bill. But the committee also made the note that nothing has been done, and thus the reason that the bill is before you. Now, in writing this report, at the time of this report was written, the land board had adopted a policy. And I'm sure that Mr. Cox will issue that policy to you
And evidently there's been some changes even in that policy. The committee also noted that the staff of the division has, since the adoption of proposed Senate Bill 36 by the advisory committee, had publicly announced the promulgation of certain guidelines that the land board was going to take on settling claims of ownership, and since that time have written to many of the riparian owners, and I think that between Corvallis, no, pardon me, between Salem and Portland, and Newburgh, have written the owners of the riparian land about their study and about their interests and about the land board's policy, and have received several discussions by the interested parties. Now, my only comment before I have Mr. Edwards discuss the situation further is that because this is the primary cause of the advisory committee to the land board, I think it's imperative that this committee adopt either Senate Bill 36 or an amended form of Senate Bill 36. Because the Division of State Land does have the power to determine the vast majority of the Willamette River, the course that it took in 1859, and the many changes that has made since that time. And because it has that ability, due to the very excellent work done by Mr. Hamilton, who is staff on Division of State Land, that this question can be settled. And perhaps it takes a directive from the legislature outlining certain procedures to get the job done. But nevertheless, the ability is there, and I would hope that the legislature would support the land board in its efforts in doing this.
Could I have that that I gave to you a little bit ago? Thank you. Okay. Right here. Senate Bill 36 that addresses itself primarily to the Willamette River. At least that was the concentration, because that was kind of the classic example, and this gives an idea of the magnitude of the problem. There's four major changes in the river. The land board has already been exercising the power that we think is in this bill. As a matter of fact, there's a case of Bernie Coons on the Mackenzie Delta, the Wiley Sand and Gravel of Eugene, North Dakota, Harrisburg, Valley River Center Exchange, Linda Ayers, Harrisburg, just to name a few, who have already received quitclaim deeds or some form of deed for their land. And the Willamette River can actually be a pilot program, because there are other rivers in the state and the 600 miles of navigable waterways of the some 60 navigable streams that have problems of more or less degree comparable to the ones that are encountered in the Willamette River. And the reason that the committee with the dissenting vote recorded took the position they did was that it was felt that it would be incomplete if the state simply asserted its ownership on what the state claims it owns, because at the present time the owners of this land that's in dispute are having a very bad time on financiability, on getting loans, on conveying it, on inheritances, and on leasing land, or any type of transaction that involves land where there's these clouds on the title. Now, there may be some other proposals that would accomplish what the bill seeks to accomplish, and some maybe more equitably. I don't know. This is what we came up with, and it was not a unanimous opinion.
Questions of our guests?
As I read the bill, I don't see any direction to the land board, to the division, for a policy matter. And for instance, something in regard to the suggestion was made that they start out by going by where the water is now. Maybe that'd be unconstitutional, I don't know. But,
Madam Chairman, this method of settling the issue was discussed by the advisory committee. It is absolutely the simplest way to solve the problem. To simply say, well, where the river is now is where our interest is. But after you begin discussing that issue, you find that there are certain cases where abandoned channels may indeed belong to the state of Oregon, that loss of revenue to this common school fund is questionable, that it may be the simplest, but it's not the most equitable. So the committee did not settle on that method of solving the problem.
Well, then, Chairman, is it your view and the view of the majority of the committee that this should not have any direction to the guidelines to the land board?
I would think, Senator Hoyt, that it not only is a guideline, but directs them the method by which it will be settled. That's the deadline.
Wasn't the assumption of the advisory committee that in the absence they would apply the common law?
Yes, I think that's correct.
That's what's in the report. That is what's in the report. May I be further responsive to the Senator's question?
Please.
There are some instances where the riparian owner claims where the river is. In fact, in your county, the court awarded 1/3 of a mile of the Willamette River to John Gallagher. So it's a little bit difficult in the state of Oregon, in view of these court decisions, to take the simple approach and follow the course of the stream, which is done in Texas. And I guess other states, I am familiar with the fact that it is done there. But we have these instances where the riparian owner claims that the river got there evulsively, and he claims where it is and not where it was. So that complicates it, and the court has recognized those, at least one of those claims to my knowledge. There may be others.
Where a stream bed is changed, evulsively,
and I think you're right. And it's got it.
Well, we're in a hurry so they can see it happen overnight.
That's right.
Does the situation never change, even for 100 or 200 years? Does the ownership still stay with the people that owned that land before the river had this convulsion?
I think Mr. Hawes, Madam Chairman, enunciated the common law on that.
From the standpoint, it isn't a movement unless it's a matter of accretion.
And time has nothing to do with it. Land River is now 20 miles from where it used to be, but in 100 years from now, it's still that new land belongs to the guy that owned it before the river moved.
Madam
in a hurry.
Madam Chairman.
Do you want to answer that, please?
Essentially, you're right. Time has nothing to do with it. If the fact is established that an emulsion occurred, then the effect of the emulsion in law, under case law now, is that the title remains the same forever and ever unless the parties do something.
Well, the old East River up there above the sea from Cracker Island belongs to the state, and that happened overnight practically, but it was
well
over there.
See, that's one of the issues that brought this up. The Corvallis Sand and Gravel case is a nice example where you had. Is that the East River?
There's three East Rivers over there.
All right, well, it's one of the East Rivers that was really the old bend, the old meander of the river. It was cut across. They said that was abortion, I guess, didn't they? And so, in effect, Corvallis Sand and Gravel now owns however many river miles between those two points of the old meander. All right, that's the effect of abortion. Corvallis Sand and Gravel now has title by court decision to the land, to the current bed of the Willamette River, the main channel.
To the edge, you mean?
The actual bed. That's the effect of a ruling of abortion.
Mr. Herman, do you want to comment?
Well, I wanted to say that part of the decision is on appeal. I would also like to say that I think our contention is going to be both from the facts and circumstances of divorce is a lot much, much more rare than people seem to give it credit. I think it's a very rare fact of occurrence on the Willamette River, and I think if we can get a court to reverse this ruling of the circuit court, that it would simplify the division's job on this Willamette River project.
Well,
Madam Chairman, the only comment that I would make in regards to what Mr. Herman's suggestion is that perhaps the committee should be advised by the division of the progress of their report, which will indicate that in their own conclusion that 90% of the river from Newburgh to Salem, if you will, or perhaps even further than that, can that the status can be determined. Very little of it is caused by avulsion or even suspected to be, so that the problem is not near as great as it may appear. As a matter of fact, they will come with suggested amendments to this bill that perhaps eliminates some of the formalities that even the advisory committee felt were necessary after they began negotiating with the riparian owners.
Madam Chairman,
I think it should be mentioned in answer to Senator Hoyt's question that prior to 1909, speaking of time, adverse possession did prevail against the state in a number of these river cases, and there's three Supreme Court cases in point on that. I think also it should be mentioned that the Willamette River is unique in one respect, and in 1872 the state granted to the riparian owner the land to the low water line. Otherwise, your friend used to be a legislator here.
Lawrence
Smith, most of his land is belongs to the state because it's all floodplain.
Well, that's the one thing I'm most interested in getting an answer to is that in view of the two witnesses here at the table, that the bill as it stands, without any further guidelines or directions of the land board, is the way the committee feels it ought to be. Is that correct?
Well, Madam Chairman, I would qualify that by saying this. First of all, the Division of State Lands and the Land Board adopted a policy in November of 1972 that encompassed almost all the recommendations of the Advisory Committee bill. And you'll testify to that later on. And since having worked under that policy and proceeding to negotiate with the riparian landowners, have determined that some of the recommendations of this bill may need to be changed because they are too cumbersome. That perhaps we are requiring too much policy or too much procedure. And I think that the committee should hear that information and perhaps change the bill to meet those recommendations.
Madam Chairman, are you referring to Representative Katz? On page 4 of the Senate bill, on page 4, line 13, there's an amendment proposed that everything after the word parties be deleted.
Is there any other business before the committee? Committee is adjourned.